Hey, Norman Hobbs here, speaking with Tan Stoffel of Age of Treason. I will add his blog to the description at the end of this. I forgot to put it in beforehand. But tonight we will be discussing evolution, DNA, the origins of our people, and the many contradictory and conflicting narratives coming out about the origins of our species overall, or alleged species, which we'll get into that in a while. Tan, there's actually a couple different things we were going to be hitting tonight, so I'll leave it up to you to kind of which direction you want to take it in first. I mean, I guess the best place is at the beginning, out of Africa versus multi-regional.
Right, well, chronological is logical. I made a post where I tried to present a couple of images that we can refer to while we're talking here. Unfortunately, it's not good for people listening on audio, but that should make them want to come and take a look at the post to see what we're talking about. We can describe it as we go. But this is really it's about a conflict between a narrative that comes primarily from Jews, and it's driven by Jews. And it's to the detriment of whites. And it's about our beginnings. It's about our origins. It's about our heritage. And so it's important. It's important to us, and it should be important to us to get it straight and be clear about to the extent we can. I mean, the caveat I'd like to add right here at the beginning is I'm an amateur. I do this part-time. I have an interest in this, and I pay attention to what's going on, but I'm not. My employment is not in biology, it's not in genetics. I'm an outsider looking in, so there might be things I'm missing, but I think I take an active interest in it. I'm intelligent enough to understand most of what's happening, and I'm skeptical and yet have an open mind too about the information that I'm taking in. And I try to digest it, and in the past I've made several posts and podcasts basically putting what I've learned into terms that I think make it even more understandable for other people that don't even have the time to put into it like I do. But there are, basically the issue that we're going to cover tonight, this origin of the white race and the threat to us, the enemy, is something that you don't really need to be a scientist to understand. Science helps you understand the technical details of what's happening. But in the same way that you don't have to be a physicist to throw a baseball or to catch one, it's just sort of burned into your brain. So is racial instinct. It is in our brains. It's innate. We inherit it. It's part of what enabled us and our ancestors to survive for as long as we have to become who we are. So that's enough as for an introduction, I think.
All right, so yeah, I'm kind of looking at this. I guess we're going to be throwing around some technical terms, so a quick beginning might be difference between hominid and hominin.
Yeah, the very first graph I present it in the post on this that I think is important to talk about is a graph or a tree, a display of the hominids. This is the us and our closest ape relatives. So we're basically a hairless ape and this diagram shows where DNA evidence indicates we lie in this collection of species. And there's no debate from scientists that the five figures at the top of this image represent separate species, that these are in the strictest sense, species are groups of organisms that can't interbreed, that can't produce viable offspring. And the point I wanted to make with this is where it really begins, is when you trace when you look at who we are, the largest group that we belong to that's sensibly us could be, and most people consider it, this image, with the human being in the center. And it's in the opinion of racialists who make further finer distinctions amongst men and what people call humans. This is not where we stop, but it is the largest that most people think of when they think of us. They think of us humans. Now, some people think even beyond that to all of life, or certainly all apes. They have some sort of sympathy or empathy with other primates, that's another word you could use for this particular tree, although there's far more. There's even smaller monkeys and such that branch off, that we branched off from much longer back. But you see here, the time scale is also something I wanted to call attention to, that it shows us breaking off our common ancestor from bonobos and chimpanzees 4 to 6 million years ago. So for the last 4 to 6 million years, what is called Homo or hominins, and this is where hominin differs from hominid. This is a sort of technical jargony point to make, but you see both words thrown around because both words have been used and confusingly in the past. But more recently, they've tried to narrow it down or pin it down to hominid means this whole tree, hominin, and the mnemonic you can use is the ending, I-N, think of in-group, us is hominin. And that goes back, as I say, 4 to 6 million years ago is when we branched off, our ancestors branched off from what became then bonobos and chimps. And we had that common ancestor branched off from gorillas 6 to 8 million years ago and from orangutans 12 to 16 million years ago. And these are estimates. Another point I'd like to make right here at the beginning, even as a layman, I understand that basically this science is subject to change. It's what the best estimate is based on certain models of mutation rates and so forth, that when they're looking at the DNA of all of these organisms, that these are the rough estimates they have of when the interbreeding stopped between these different species.
Right. The numbers have shifted actually quite a bit over the years. You know, we'll get into out of Africa in a second. The original out of Africa theory it's been debunked. I mean, the original out of Africa theory was, correct me if I'm wrong, 40 to 60,000 years ago, the ancestors of all modern humans came out of Africa, went to all the continents, exterminated or spread disease and killed all the other hominins, and we solely and only descend from them. DNA evidence has proven that's not true. We do have admixture, and also that number's been pushed back of when the colonization of the continents began from the first, quote unquote, modern humans.
Yeah, and the competing theory was the multi-regional origins or multi-regional hypothesis, which I think the most popular form of that was that we were all descended from Homo erectus, but meaning all the various races of man that currently exist on the planet, but that we diverged and evolved separately and crossed the threshold of intelligence and civilization at different times, and that some branches of that Homo erectus family never crossed the line, never invented the wheel, for instance, amongst the Africans or amongst the I remember a story Revel Oliver told about how Australoids, the Abos in Australia, never understood really how pregnancy worked, that sex led to babies. When they first met the white man was amazed to discover that.
That shows an amazing lack of deductive reasoning. Like that's below retardation.
Yeah, you wonder if you could talk to chimpanzees, would chimpanzees realize that sex led to babies? It reminds me of another thing, a little racist factoid about the mirror reflex, that in young black infants, they don't show an ability to recognize themselves in a mirror. They don't have that self-awareness. And I think it's similar to chimpanzees in that regard, whereas non-blacks, everybody else besides blacks, as infants do at a certain early age, recognize themselves in a mirror, show that self-awareness. Anyway, that's we're kind of digressing. The point you made about the out of Africa theory is that it has changed over time, that the original proposed theory was 40 to, and I had seen 40 to 45 45,000 years ago, that we were all, we all had common ancestors 40 to 45,000 years ago. Then we left, as you said, we exterminated all of our competitors, our nearby competitors, and left Africa and spread out and populated the world. And that was the just so story until genetics started to disrupt that story. And it was actually already contradicting archaeological evidence, because the multi-regional hypothesis was based on archaeological evidence, linguistic evidence, and this out of Africa thing was really politicized. It was, in fact, what the anti-racist activists' enemy basically accused the early white scientists who were investigating race, what they accused them of, pseudoscience, making up stories to fit their political agenda, and basically running roughshod over the facts and the reality. And that is what we actually have today, and what we've had for at least 100 years, and certainly ever since the end of World War II, is we've got anti-racists now dictating this out of Africa, we are all Africans mentality, that really, that's the point of it, is to make it a point of faith, a religious precept, that we are all related to each other. We're all family. We're all, you know, directly connected, equal, whatever, equally capable. And the only explanation for differences is white racism, whites being bigots. That's the only accepted answer to the question of why there are such obvious differences. And as time has passed since the end of World War II, the science being done in genetics has uncovered truths that can't really be hushed up. Too many people are learning about these things, and they're publishing information that is now, it's overturning out of Africa, but lots of other things, and primarily the whole lie, the whole anti-racist lie that biology, there is no biological basis for race, is a big fat lie.
Yeah, and this is kind of a little separate side point, but I've made this point before. One of the little tricks they did was they removed a concept in early race science, sub-race. The reason they're able to nitpick and say
subspecies, you mean?
No, in early racial studies, there was a category of subrace, slightly below race. Mm. So if you add subrace back into the equation, their ability to argue, oh, well, Middle Easterners, are they white? Are they something else? You know, how many races are there? What race are Native Americans? If you factor back in subrace, that underneath the major continental races, there is more fine grained areas, and a lot of that kind of pill argumentation goes away.
Yeah, excellent point. I had wanted to talk about the species problem, which is basically a classification problem. And you're right. One of the main criticisms of racialists and race science was that race scientists can't even agree how many races there are, and they can't point to where the dividing lines are between the various races. And it's really disingenuous, because you don't have to be very intelligent to realize that there's no stark line between red and yellow. It's a continuum, and where the races meet geographically, there's mixing, and so there's not a black and white line, unless, I mean, there are places where the geographic boundaries are so strong that, for instance, in Africa, there's those hominins are totally different than the hominins found elsewhere. There was very little mixing there across those boundaries, the Sahara. That's why they call them sub-Saharan Africans. But the point I wanted to make is that they're being disingenuous. Everybody who tries to do categorization of any phenomenon, not just the races of man, but even of species, of any animal, finds this problem. They call it the species problem in biology, of where do you draw the line with species? And most people are familiar with the classic definition of species, which has to do with, I mentioned it at the beginning, whether two organisms can interbreed and produce viable offspring is the most common, hardest definition. But there are all sorts of species that are called species that really aren't incapable of producing viable offspring. A good example is grizzly bears and polar bears, where you can, or lions and tigers even, you can cross those things, especially they cross when they're under stress in an environment or in a zoo, which says something about domestication. But they don't naturally do that. They naturally go their own way because speciation, this force that basically causes life to adapt and differentiate and try every possible way of doing things and the best survives, this idea that Darwin came across and developed, is the main force. It is constantly, you take a single homogenous population and it will start to subdivide. Just, it's sort of like the law of entropy of biology, that species will form.
Right. And as for the interbreeding point, that is the common line they tell us, is that's where the dividing line is wherever two species can't. But as you've made the point, things that we consider separate species can interbreed. Lions and tigers can interbreed. I can't remember. Is it the female that's infertile? No, it's the male that's infertile and the female that's fertile.
Yeah, well, I don't know what it is for lions and tigers, but just to continue that point, it's a continuum. And it has to do with the amount of genetic difference between the two organisms. The longer they're apart, the more their mutations accumulate. And eventually, some of those mutations start affecting the sexual reproduction mechanics. And you get all sorts of strange things malfunctioning before you finally get like a totally sterile offspring, and then get no offspring at all. And at a certain point, you get physical incompatibility. I mean, the one male can't stick its thing and the other thing's female because they're just physically incapable of mating. But that takes millions of years. Chris Stringer, who's a scientist, one of the primary scientists that promoted the idea of the out of Africa theory, recently wrote a statement. As this out of Africa narrative has been modified in light of this new genetic information that's coming out, he wrote a statement where he said that, he was making the argument that basically we need to consider all of these recently extinct hominins like Neanderthal and Denisovans and some of these other mystery ones that they haven't given names to yet, but they've discovered in the DNA. We need to consider them all part of Homo, all part of our species. Again, it's sort of the basic underlying theme is just like it's a prime directive that we're all one race, the migrating mixing nigger race, as I put it. But he said he admitted that basically in nature, two organisms need to be sexually separate for 1 to 2 million years before they will develop enough. That's a rough rule of thumb for before they'll develop into a full-blown, cannot produce viable offspring speciation. But of course, along the way, they become less and less capable of making good babies. And there are several articles I've seen and collected over the years about Neanderthals in particular, because when they discovered that Neanderthals had interbred with all non-Africans back 40,000 years ago or so, they think is when it happened most recently. The incompatibilities were already large enough that it created problems, that they think that that there was some, as you mentioned, a sexual asymmetry, that it could be human females and male Neanderthals or the other way around, but that the other way didn't work, and that they even sort of had an inkling of why that was. They know enough now about how the sexual reproduction machinery works. And I'm talking about, inside the sperm and egg and what happens directly after conception. They're starting to understand that well enough now that they can actually just look at a strip of DNA and tell whether it would work or not. And that's something that will be coming in the decades to come. I mean, assuming white scientists are continued to work, they will understand that even better than they know now.
Right. And it's kind of funny. We're actually beginning, at least from what I've read, to see beginnings of the phenomenon between the major continental races. I've read that African and European couples have a high, well, actually generally race mixed couples have a higher rate of stillborn births. Asian women carrying white men's children at a greater risk for gestational diabetes. Of course, we all know about the weird problem from mental illness, but you could argue about what causes that. So there are problems even between the major continental races in humans when you have crossbreeding now.
Yeah, good point. That's an example of exactly what I'm talking about. And that's if you could talk to a doctor or a geneticist and get them to be honest, I think that they would admit that that's exactly what it is. It's you've got two groups that have started to speciate, and now you're crossing them that you're going to see problems. It's quite the opposite of the narrative of that the Jews try to sell, that there's hybrid vigor, that there when you race mix between black and white, that you get some sort of stronger, better type of human. That's just a lie.
Yeah, no doubt it supports that they have like, I've read they mulattoes actually have a higher rate of crime than pure blacks. I don't know if that's true, but I know that they have high rates of addiction, high rates of mental illness, all kinds of problems, and their IQ tends to be in the middle on average. The one exception that I've read on Ron Oon's article was if the black has some weird variations for higher IQ and they're like 10, 15 points above their group's average, they're like a 95 IQ black naturally, and they mix with an average IQ white, possibly a 1 to million, the chances come together where it gets some of those positive mutations and it comes out slightly higher than both groups' averages, like 105, but that's an incredibly rare coin flip. 9 times out of 10, it's going to be somewhere in between the group's averages.
Yeah, I hadn't seen that. So if you can provide that link, I'll add it to my post about this. So let's scroll down to the next graph, I think that we or diagram that I think we ought to discuss here is zooming in a little bit now on this one branch of the first image that is what I'm calling hominins that branched off from the rest of the hominids 4 to 6 million years ago, our closest ape relatives. And this zooms into the current scientific thinking as of 650,000 years or so ago and the various branchings that there's only two little nubs that they show in the first image, but here they expand it out and show the much more complicated view of that is starting to approach the multi-regionalism idea. This is where the out of Africa narrative now has shown that it's basically false, that the 40,000 years ago, and we exterminated all of our nearest and replaced all of our nearest relatives and spread out around the globe is given the lie right here in this image. This is the most current thinking based on actually looking at DNA and not just Jews telling stories. So here are a couple of things that are clear from this diagram is it shows, for instance, these Neanderthal and Denisovan type hominins branching off from the rest of us 650,000 years ago. And the Neanderthal branched off first, and then the Denisovan, they think, branched off from Neanderthal. And then they subdivided a little later than that. And then eventually one or more of those branches mixed with various groups of humans, what we think of as humans today. There's also, on this graph at least, diagram, an older branch that branched off even before that, 700 or more thousand years ago, an unknown hominin. And there are actually several of these. I've read stories about how Pacific Islanders, Papuans on Papua New Guinea, actually have a fairly strong component of some mystery hominin that could very well be that's what's represented right here on this one. But I think actually that little arrow that's pointing to Denisovan, they're trying to say that they must have, when looking at the Denisovan DNA, they must have seen this. Bits of mystery DNA in the Denisovan that the Neanderthals didn't have. And that's what this is, this unknown hominin. So maybe the one I'm thinking about with the Papuans is a different one. But the point I wanted to make, another point I wanted to make here is that they show the populations of us, this supposed collective one race, the migrating mixing nigger race, is really actually lots of different branches. They divided into On the far right, Oceania, that would be the Australoids, the Abos and I suppose also calling it Oceania, they mean the South Pacific Islanders. And in America, and by America, they mean the what we call Indians, the native or indigenous, supposedly indigenous. That's a whole other story. We could talk about that narrative, about who occupied North and South America first. How did that happen? But that's what they mean by that. And they show that as a separate branch, of course, from Oceania. That all branches off from the East Asian branch. Because what the old racialists used to call Mongoloids, and they show here in this diagram is East Asia, the Native Americans or Indians that populated North and South America were known to be, just from looking at them, but long before they had DNA, they hypothesized that those peoples must have been related in some distant form to the Mongoloids in Asia. And likewise for the Pacific Islanders. And sure enough, the DNA has vindicated that suspicion, that hypothesis. At least that's what the current science seems to indicate. And this is one of the mildest, because it doesn't even have to do with white people, really, except for the fact that the white people got the understanding of reality right and have been vilified for it for the last 100 years, been called pseudoscientists. And here is genetics now basically vindicating them. But it's one of the mildest revelations of this recent genetic research. So then the next one we come to is the one that we're interested in, which is European and Western Asia. They sometimes call them Eurasians, right? And which is, they mean the Western marches of Asia, where the a large component of European genetics comes from, Siberia. And there they provide a little zoomed in graph that we're going to get into more detail next, but we'll just mention here is labeled ancestral European, which shows several sub branches and the various mixings between them, which makes up modern Europeans. And then as you continue all the way on the left hand side at the bottom, is Africa, which shows three separate strands, which means basically three separate sub-races. As you mentioned earlier, this when we say black, people nowadays just think of black as basically this vague group of anybody who has really dark skin. And what they don't realize is that genetic research is revealing that there are very, very old and significant differences even amongst modern blacks who are still in Africa, never left Africa, and are still roaming around inside Africa. And they trace those differences back in this graph all the way back up to 150,000 years ago. And the supposed out of Africa exodus that happened, where all the rest of us left Africa, branched off of just one of those branches about 100 or 75,000 years ago, they're showing on this diagram. But this is the really sort of shattering, out of Africa shattering visual revelation that we aren't all one race. Even if you take the out of Africa, the latest version of the out of Africa theory as true, you can see that we're not all part of one group that left Africa. This is a very strong contradiction of that whole narrative. It shows that there are groups in Africa that we are not related to as recently as 100,000 years ago. It goes back at least 150. And I'll add right now, and I'll continue to remind in this podcast if I can, the fact that they underestimate, these are underestimates. These are lowball values, these time ranges that they're providing here, because they are still trying hard to basically save the out of Africa, we're all one race narrative. And so just like when they talk about how many illegal immigrants are in America and they say, oh, 11 million, they've been saying that for 25 years. There's far more than that. And they're not giving numbers in good faith. But what this says this graph here is that we are at least 100 to 150,000 years diverged, speciated from what we call blacks today, we meaning white people, and we're some 40,000 or 50,000 years speciated from what we call Asians, the East Asians and South Asians.
Sorry, I was muted for a second. Yeah, and that brings up an interesting study. Everyone's probably familiar with the Rosenberg study. And the Rosenberg study, assuming three, it was East Eurasian, West Eurasian, and African. Now, for some reason, when he broke it into four, it broke Native Americans off from East Eurasian before breaking off Oceanian people. But I believe that was a mistake in the data of just the level of admixture that has occurred between Mongoloid and Australoid people in Southeast Asia and throughout the Pacific Islands. I think the straight four would be the West Eurasian, East Eurasian, Australoid or Malaysian, and the Sub-Saharan African.
Yeah, the estimates for times and divergences here in these types of graphs, there's two reasons that they change over time. And one is that they're manipulated or distorted by an effort to kind of hide the truth. But then there's also just there are good actors out there, people who really want to get to the truth and who are operating in good faith. And they just their models are wrong for one reason or another. And you basically just outlined one way that can happen, that they use a model of admixture that's too simple or wrong in some other way, assumes too many or too few components, and they don't get it right. And it's actually messier than that. So even if you get the coarse number of components right, there is finer grain stuff going on in different places at different times. And so it's difficult to model. But, you know, one of the things that the anti-racists drive a wedge into and pry open is the objectivity and fair-mindedness of people who really are investigating this with an open mind and trying to be objective about it and fair-minded about it and to look at the facts as they are rather than what they want them to be. And they then sow doubt in your mind with arguments like we talked about, that they mock people for not agreeing on the basic number of races, when the whole idea of race and every racialist that there's ever been, or at least any of the serious ones, has always acknowledged that it's basically a continuum. It's but that doesn't mean that there aren't components, that there aren't strong categories that you can identify and make sense understanding the history of.
Yeah, and like I was saying earlier, if you make it a little more fine-grained than continental race, you go down to sub-race, some of these problems disappear. Like, technically, according to classic skull measurements and modern genetic clustering, Middle Easterners are part of the greater Caucasian West Eurasian race, but obviously we can look at it and see that functionally these are two different breeds. So you can say, okay, they're close enough maybe to be part of the same broad continental race, but they're clearly very functionally different sub-races.
Yes, exactly. And we have different histories, we have different heritages, we have different genetics. So in a graph like this one, under the Europe and Western Asia, they're mixing together a lot of people that basically don't really fit. And so that's why we're going through it in this order, that we start with the coarsest possible, you know, hominin category, and then we're going to focus in on that. We're going to get finer here as we go along, and we'll differentiate where Jews and other Middle Easterners fit in to all of this in a moment. But yeah, basically, when I first started to investigate this, and I asked questions of myself and went out looking for answers to of who's white and where's the line, you know, who's not white, I found that there are lots and lots of people who have thought about these things and have written about these things, published books on these things. And the way that the Jews prevailed ultimately was they destroyed their enemies or got their enemies to destroy each other. And they, like they do today, they just ban voices of disagreement, voices of dissent. They burn the books of scholars of the past who, as we know now, were actually more right, even in their guesses about what the origins of European man were and prehistory was. And let's be honest, I mean, what we're talking about is prehistory here. We're talking about long before anybody's written down documented heritage of their family tree. We're talking about the stuff that goes back thousands of years before that. And nobody really knows for sure every little detail about what happened. It's just that what DNA is revealing is something new, a new way of a new bit of a new line of evidence, a totally independent line of evidence from what we previously had, scientists previously had, in the form of archaeology and linguistics. Those were the two main ways and lenses through which scientists of the past, or even just amateur speculators like myself, the way they looked into the past was using either archaeology, the evidence of archaeology, or linguistics. Genetics has added a whole nother independent arm to that, and in many ways has clarified what was already known and is overturning other things that people pretended that they knew but didn't really and took on faith. And the things that are being overturned are mainly the Jew lies. That's what's so gratifying about investigating this stuff. Although they still are able, through the force of their media, to continue to promote those lies. And that's one of the last images in my post here. We can get into that.
Yeah, I'd like to make a point on that, though. What they do is, when they can no longer dispute the facts, they just fall back on spinning narrative. I've heard the narrative spun, oh, well, nationalism, racialism is invalid because our ancestors fucked Neanderthals. Therefore, there is no validation to racial categories. I've often joked that if tomorrow the evidence was definitively proven that there were racial differences in intelligence, the new narrative would be that whites have a kind of genetic privilege, and because we abused it by conquering the genetically inferior, we are now morally obligated to breed with these people out of reparations to bring them up.
Yeah, narrative is very flexible, especially when you are willing to just lie and tell direct things that directly contradict reality. Say black is white and white is black, and you can get away with it. Yeah, if you lack scruples, you can do that, and it works to a certain extent. But there are instincts, and people feel an instinctive revulsion to mixing when they see it in other animals, when they see it in their own kind. They do feel that in spite of the indoctrination and the propaganda that that Jews have used for a very long time now.
Yeah, they've done studies. They've shown pictures. People are instinctually revolted with mixed race couples. And as William Luther Pierce pointed out, when whites mix, I mean, there's a very bottom category of our mix that mixes with phenotypic non-whites. But when you see a white person of a higher quality, physically attractive mixing, it's usually with an already mixed person. White people tend to mix with off-whites, not full-on non-whites. And I mean, that's not okay. I'm not validating that, but I'm just saying that's part of the pattern. It's a very small category of whites that'll mix with full-on non-whites. And then as you get into higher levels of admixture and more Caucasian features, you get up to a point where most whites instinctually wouldn't object, to the point where only a conscious racialist would object to mixing with, like, someone that's 1/8 non-white, 7/8 white, because their facial features would be, like, totally Caucasian. William Pierce actually made the point that that's what really we should be worried about. Beware the almost white.
Yeah, Jews in particular. Yeah, it's a continuum. There's a gradation in the revulsion that's felt and the actual difference, the visible difference, because there has been mixing. I mean, we're going to talk about this in the very next slide here, or these new next images is the evidence, the genetic evidence that there has been mixing. And the point I would make about that, and sometimes it's exaggerated. You mentioned somebody who basically has referred to Europeans as mutts or Americans as mutts. This is something you see even amongst racialists, that the white Americans describe themselves as mutts sometimes because they're a mix of, say, French and German or French and British or something like that. And hopefully in our discussion here, we can get into this a little bit, is that it's not really what they're describing. When people talk about mutts in the form of dogs, they mean like one breed of dog breeding with another breed of dog that's visibly different and creating some mystery dog from that mix. And the same sort of thing happens with humans or hominins. When the major races mix, you get something that doesn't quite look like either race. And that's because mixing like that is the exception rather than the rule. I mean, you wouldn't have noticeable mixing if there weren't noticeably distinct, partly speciated branches to begin with. But the point I wanted to make is that the mixing that we're going to talk about next year, and we might as well just get into it here, is these components of European ancestry and the models that they've come up with recently to understand the DNA of bones anywhere from 40,000 or so years ago to a couple of thousand years ago in that range of prehistory. They've modeled on three major components, and it seems to fit and explain the data pretty well. There's probably, you know, some subtle edge cases that are not explained so well, but this idea, this model seems to fit. And it's this, the three mixtures or the three components are Western hunter-gatherer, WHG it's called. That's sort of the base European, the people who peopled Europe 40,000 years or so ago. And then there's the early European farmer is another component. And those people came into Europe from the Anatolian Peninsula some 7 to 9,000 years ago. And then there's the ancient North Eurasian or the Yamnaya, which were also, they carried basically the ancient North Eurasian, A-N-E, was sort of the secret sauce or the special sauce that they carried into Europe, which made them Aryans, which made them different, because they were basically just another branch of hunter-gatherer, the Eastern hunter-gatherers that were very closely related to the Western hunter-gatherers. They were basically all three of these components, and this is the main point, the main takeaway, were racial cousins. They were very similar to each other. They were different enough that they, you know, saw each other as competitors, and they no doubt they warred with each other, but they mixed with each other as well. And eventually they blended into a fairly homogenous blend in Europe. Although all of the European diversity that we see today, the dark hair in the south, the light hair in the north, the blue eyes and the brown eyes and the different complected skins, comes from basically the different mixtures of these three components in the various types of Europeans. And the point is that all of those peoples, I call them racial cousins, they were all descended from the same group of people that had separated from the rest of humanity, the rest of the hominins, some 40,000 years earlier. So they just came together again after being separated for 5,000, 10,000, 15,000 years, something like that is probably the most extreme. And they didn't look very different. They had some technological differences. The Yamnaya, for instance, had domesticated animals and had the wheel and the chariot, and used those advantages to conquer and then spread their genes in that way. But I don't want to get ahead of ourselves.
I'd like to interject kind of controversy there. I've heard that they've actually broken it down to four points, that the Yamnaya, the Aryans, were actually a mix of two separate, the Caucasian or Eastern hunter-gatherers and the ancestral North Eurasians. And I've heard some controversy around ancestral North Eurasians. I've heard that they were arguably a proto-Mongoloid people, not a proto-Europid, and that their closest living cousin today would be Native Americans and some Central Asians.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because the reason I said that I'm just reading from this slide here that lists only A&E, which is basically just code for the Yamnaya or Aryans, which is code for Aryans, is they were, I've read the same thing, that they were actually themselves a composite of two almost a 50-50 mix of what is called A&E and what is Eastern hunter-gatherer. And this graph here, the one I'm thinking of and looking at right now is the one that's the orange and blue and green bars that show the percentages of modern Europeans on the top and some ancient European mixes in the bottom half, that shows the very strong A&E component on the right-hand side, the green, strongest amongst Norwegians, right? The people that were identified by racialists 100, 150 years ago as the most Aryan people, they were right. The Nordic people, the Scandinavians, have the most A&E, and thereby, you know, by inference, the inherited the most genes from the invading Yamnaya Aryans. The point you're making about the closest relatives today to these A&E samples being North Americans is explained by current scientists as basically like the Yamnaya themselves. They went two different directions, that the A&E people spread east and west. They mixed with the Yamnaya on the edge of Asia, the western edge of Asia, and then the Yamnaya took those genes into Europe. But they also spread or were already present in the eastern parts of northern Asia. And so they hitched a ride along with the peoples, the Mongoloids, who supposedly migrated along the Bering, Beringia land bridge when the oceans were lower, and carried those genes into America. And so the signal that they found there, I mean, some racialists, when they saw these genes had been discovered in Native Americans, they said, oh, see, there's some evidence of Europeans that carried that into Europe. And the jury's still out. I wouldn't bet on it one way or the other. But the current sober scientific explanation for this is not that Europeans brought it into North America, but that it was brought in, carried by these Mongoloid migrants via the Bering Strait.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Mutation rates and stuff like that. In the same way that they can look at DNA of Neanderthals and or Denisovans and tell that there's a bit of alien, yet another type of hominin in them. You know, they look at the mutations that they see in those particular strands, those mystery strands.
Yeah, I've heard that too, that the genetic evidence for a European presence in North America is actually just the fact that the Mongoloids that crossed over were themselves somewhat hybridized and had
DNA. Yeah, the other evidence, the I would think is even stronger evidence. There's two. There's the archaeological evidence of Clovis-like stone tools that were found that are very similar in North America, that were very similar to stone tools that were in use in France. Tens of thousands of years ago. I don't quote me on this, but it's something like, you know, when peoples first started, the Cro-Magnon man first started resettling Europe as the ice receded from it 40 to 45,000 years ago, that some of those people followed the ice sheet sort of in the reverse of the Bering Strait. This is the Columbus, I forget what they call it, Ice Age Columbus is the documentary that outline this hypothesis, that those peoples took their stone tool making knowledge and they migrated along the ice edge into North America. And they left behind, as I say, stone implements that were found. And also, I forget, Kennewick Man, I think is his name. There's a skeleton that was discovered in Northeast U.S., that has very European looking features. And in the past, before genetics, scientists looked at skeletons and analyzed them, measured them very precisely to differentiate amongst the different species of man. And this is something they still do to this day. When bones are the only thing that they have, they look at, for instance, I don't know, Homo naledi, which they've discovered in South Africa in a cave, and they compare it to all of these other very ancient bones that they can't get DNA from yet. And they use skull measurements. They show you pictures. Look, see how this one has heavier brow ridges and so forth. Well, this Kennewick man, when they first dug him up, even the non-specialists of the day could look at it and say, that's a skeleton of a white man. And so there's been a controversy for a long time over that.
Oh, yeah. I didn't mean to totally dismiss the idea of whites in North America. There's archaeological. I know some people that were involved in the Kennewick thing when it was first found. And even like the first person that the coroner, because originally I thought it might have been a murder victim, was like, this is a white guy.
Yeah. And that's one of the facts that contradicts the Jew narrative on race is forensic investigators can actually tell the race. Generally, given a skeleton, and especially the skull, they can tell the race of the skeleton.
Yeah, so, all the way down to, I think it's four or five major clusters, right? The Mongoloid, Caucasoid, Negroid, Australoid, and what's the other one?
I don't know.
There's the Congoid.
Capoid.
Yeah, Coons split blacks into two. He said that the skulls were distinct enough.
Yeah, racialists in the past made distinctions amongst the Africans that in that graph that we just considered up above, the green one, genetics is revealing, yeah, they really are genetically distinct from each other, these categories that racists recognized long before there was DNA evidence, because they just used their eyes and their brains.
Yeah, it's funny to read articles where they try to keep a calm face, but you can tell they're kvetching, because, like, literally the Nazi Aryan mythos is, like, real. That's what the genetics is showing, like, the Nazis were right, or at least they were closer than the Jews, and that's what the genetics is now beginning to bear out.
Yeah, there's a post I linked to that I wrote about a year ago. I think it was just before or just after I talked to you last, about Greg Cochran. He did a very long podcast talking about this prehistory of the Aryans specifically. And he didn't just talk about it and describe it. He also described the sort of meta-political zeitgeist of today and ever since World War II. He pointed out that there were people before World War II that understood this stuff, had guessed about it, and were right about it, and had been vilified ever since the war, but were being vindicated now by the recent genetic discoveries. And he should know. I mean, he is actually working far more closely in this field professionally than I am. So I defer to him and his opinion, at least on that. But it just kind of confirms what you and I are talking about, that this is a a Jew lie, basically, the idea that the Aryans were a myth, and it was just something that the Nazis, the evil Nazis, made up to justify their conquests of the peoples around them. This is something that you see even now in the stories about these genetic results being revealed. The stories about David Reich and his book, Who We Are, it's all this hand-wringing about, you know, this information is revealing the lie, and what are we going to do about it? How do we deal with the fact that our lies have been revealed, and we still have to somehow, you know, keep the Nazis from making hay out of this?
Right, and kind of get back where we were. I don't know if you saw, but Reich, in a recent interview, he was like, well, these different components mixing in Europe would have been as different as modern Europeans and East Asians, which is nonsense, as you just kind of talked about.
Yeah, it's not true.
It gets into a term that is kind of foreboding nowadays in anthropology, Cro-Magnon man. Yeah. I've heard it's actually the most accurate term for our race.
Yeah, yeah, that's a point I made in that post, The White Race and Its Discontents, about a year and a half ago now. I was basically spurred by the political discourse, the contemporary political discourse around Trump. He had made some speech in Poland, and he talked about Western civilization, and a bunch of Jews flipped out, you know, Western civilization. Oh, my God, you know, you can't talk about that. That's white racism. That's white supremacism. And, you know, the illustrative thing about that is that the telling thing is that Trump and other white politicians will not say the word white. They're afraid to even say the word white. The recent thing with Steve King, kind of really puts a point on that, where he said, you know, how did white supremacism and white nationalism and Western civilization become evil or something not good? I forget the exact quote. But, you know, basically what he was talking about there is this, the impact of Jewing. You know, he knows at a certain point in his brain, he knows it's the Jews that have created this anti-white environment, and it's anti-white. It's not anti-supremacism. It's not anti-nationalism, and it's not even anti-civilization. It's anti-white. And there are Jews quoted in one of the stories I found on them going after Steve King and trying to drum him out of power, drum him out of office, where some Jew said that, Steve King uses the words culture and civilization to just as cover for his real concerns, which are about whiteness and racial racism. And that's really just the Jew revealing that he knows what the score is. He knows what's going on. He knows what his hostility is towards and what he sees a threat from, a potential threat from. And unfortunately for us, Steve King is just another cuck who, you know, basically licks the boots of the Jews who kick him as much as Trump does. So anyway, I went off on a tangent there. Sorry about that. I was talking about, I wrote and talked about this issue about the Cro-Magnons having to do with what's his name? Beinart was Peter Beinart was one of the most toxic Jews that flipped out about Trump's statement back in the summer of 2017. And so I quoted him and I outlined basically who we are as a race, which is just to sum it up here, as far back as 40,000 years ago, they found a sample Stenki 14 that basically showed the components that we all modern Europeans have, maybe a different mix of the three components, but they're all there. You know, it's very similar to modern day Scandinavians, these bones look like. And I think in light of more recent discoveries, they're saying that he's actually kind of an A&E. I'll have to go and nail that down, but I think it's close. He's basically part of the A&E group before the Aryans, 40,000 years ago.
I remember reading about what they found him, and the original line was going to be, oh, he's going to be some kind of Mongoloid. He's going to be genetically similar to Siberians. No, he was obviously Caucasoid and genetically basically the same as modern white people, and closest living cousins would be Scandinavians.
Yes, and they were in Siberia at the time. That's where they found the bones. And what they rely on, the people who are trying to distort the understanding of that fact, are relying on the fact that people kind of think that everybody is static, that Africans are in Africa and stayed in Africa, and likewise that Europeans only are in Europe, and being in Europe is what makes you a European. And even some racialists fall into this. I fall into it too. You know, I call them by their geographic names, these groupings, rather than racial nomenclature, which would be more accurate. But the point is that this 40,000 year ago sample basically shows that the base foundation for Europeans was already there 40,000 years ago. And as I said, these I call them Cro-Magnons. They were fairly homogenous all the way from Siberia to the coast of Spain and from Scandinavia down to the Italian peninsula. And they were a people. They didn't, obviously they didn't communicate with each other, but there was, and they were fairly sparsely populated. They were nowhere near what we think of as thriving communities today. But there wasn't air traffic either, bringing in Sub-Saharan Africans or Southeast Asians. So they were fairly homogenous even over that vast range of time and space. And then they differentiated in their various areas to a certain extent. And this is sort of what I outline also in that The White Race and Its Discontents post podcast. As recently as 6,000 years ago, the Eastern component of that, the Aryans, were invading into Europe. and changed the face of Europe genetically, culturally, in every way. But that is basically after that. I mean, you can draw some lines here. You can say, you know, who are Europeans? Well, we started 40,000 years ago. So everything from 40,000 years on is a European that's part of this group. Or you can say, well, we weren't really us until we had finally done that final mixture of the Aryans moving in and invading in 6,000 or so, 4,000 to 6,000 years ago. And in between there, there was the 7,000 to 9,000 years ago, these early European farmers. And the relationship between the early European farmers and the Yamnaya is kind of murky in my mind. I think that they were basically just variants, genetically distinguished variants of other Caucasoid people, what came to be known later as Caucasoid. That's another name for this Cro-Magnon type of person.
Right. Yeah, and I've read, you know, that the hunter-gatherers originally came in from the Middle East. Actually, I can't remember the number, but...
No, the farmers originally came in from...
Yeah, but I've heard that actually the hunter-gatherers came in first, and then that later on the farmers came in, so that the Cro-Magnon man type may have actually started in the Middle East, not within Europe.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, and we're talking 40 to 45,000 years ago, when the ice was still covering Europe and starting to recede, the first people who peopled Europe were hunter-gatherers. They were not farmers. They had stone tools, and they hunted animals and picked berries and fished for sustenance. Yeah. And they became what the component in modern Europeans is called Western hunter-gatherer. That's the remnants of those people. Although the point I've made, again, I'll make it again, is that even these other components, the green and the orange components of the early farmers and the Yamnaya, are also cousins, racial cousins, that were not nearly as far speciated from each other as all of them are separated from East Asians or Africans.
Right, and that gets into another reason that they kind of ditched the Cro-Magnon man term, is because it became very clear that not all people kind of come from that, so they swapped it out for early modern human and fully modern human, and, you know, playing these kind of word games.
Yeah. Well, I don't know too much about it, but there's a skull that was discovered in Jebel Irhoud somewhere in the Middle East, in near modern day Israel, if not in it. That it's basically, it's a modern looking human skull, modern European looking skull, Caucasoid at least. And it's 100,000 years old based on carbon dating. And I don't think they've gotten DNA out of it, but just from, again, it's a Kennewick man type thing where that was one of the first things that threw a big monkey wrench into the out of Africa theory, because they were saying, you know, modern man didn't develop until 40 to 60,000 years ago and didn't leave Africa. And yet here we're finding this fossil that's 100,000 years ago and outside of Africa. How do you explain that? You know, so nowadays they've broadened the out of Africa theory enough to accommodate that, but it still is strange.
Right. Yeah. And that kind of gets back to the extreme human antiquity thing and the things that they found that are older.
Yeah, and Cro-Magnon, the word, I think, comes from a single sample in France that they found. That was kind of, it's not unique, but I think it was typical of this group of people that we're talking about, the 40 to 45,000 year ago prototype of Europeans. But again,
right.
I'm a little cloudy on that too, like Jebel Irhoud. I'd like to see the two of them have their DNA analyzed and compared to each other to see how they relate to each other.
Right. And the evidence seems to indicate that East Asian people don't descend from Cro-Magnon man, right? They don't have that or not.
Well, they're separate. Yeah, they went their own way. And here I guess we can talk a little bit. Our main focus here is what the roots are of Europeans. But we can at least mention here that according to that graph right above that showed the various branches of mankind, that the East Asian and South Asian types and the Pacific Islanders all branched off from white people 40 to 50,000 years ago. That's when we stopped, even if we did leave Africa, and we went our separate ways as long as 40 to 50,000 years ago. And you can imagine how many generations of people basically have been going their own way for that long. That's a long time to be separated. And the other thing in that graph, and I've read in articles about this, is that they mixed with a different group. I mean, when Cro-Magnon man entered Europe, Neanderthals were still living there. Neanderthals had basically survived the ice age of Europe. Somehow they were more robust. If you look at skulls of them, they are noticeably different. The theory is, based on the DNA that they've found in modern Europeans, is the small percentage of DNA is that we interbred with some of those at that time with some of those Neanderthals, that even though we were 500,000 years speciated from them, that we were still able to physically interbreed with them. And some of that happened. And today you can read articles about how it's not just random DNA that has survived. It's certain critical immune function type DNA. And that's one of the things that makes Europeans unique from all other peoples on the planet, different from Asians, different from Africans. Although the way they usually describe it is that we picked up this Neanderthal mixture in the Middle East somewhere because Asians also have a little slice of Neanderthal.
Yeah, it's funny, because I was just going to bring that up, that the common thing I've read is that they don't think the mixture happened in Europe for whatever reason. They insist it only happened in the Middle East.
Yeah, that the idea, fitting it to the out of Africa theory, is that this proto-human left Africa in the Middle East, encountered Neanderthal mixed, and then broke into two or more separate branches, and one went into Europe and one went into Asia, right? And the point I wanted to get at with the Asians and the difference from Europeans is that then in Asia, they mixed that branch mixed with Denisovans. And so modern day Asians, and especially these Asian Pacific Islanders, there are certain Pacific Islanders, have a very strong, you know, it's still single digits, but it's something like 3 or 4% of this Denisovan DNA. In addition to the mystery hominin that I mentioned earlier that they also have. So if you look at again, this kind of vindicates what old time racists knew just by looking at the different peoples of the planet. They knew that they were different, significantly different, that there was a substance to the difference, that it wasn't just a superficial difference, but they could see it. It wasn't just skin deep. It was in the bones, in the personalities. It was, and here we're finding the DNA is revealing basically, yeah, there's these really ancient forms of hominin that these different peoples mixed with. I mean, to put it simply, like a sort of baking recipe or components, as we're already doing with Europeans, the Africans have just the African component. Europeans have the African, quote unquote, African plus Neanderthal, and Asians have the African, Neanderthal, and Denisovan component, plus some other, you know, some of the Asians, the Pacific Islanders, have this mystery component. And then amongst Africans, another recent revelation is that there's multiple branches of Africans, and there's mystery hominins that aren't even represented in these three branches here that they've got in this diagram, that mixed with these branches of Africans after the rest of us had left Africa. So this, the out of Africa thing is really on its last legs. They're going to have to stop. Well, they won't stop calling it out of Africa. They'll just keep trying to rehabilitate it. But it's now basically it's completely shattered from its old form, its old simple form. And it's becoming more and more like the multi-regional theory all the time as DNA is uncovered about these more ancient and unique to each of the continental races, these unique components that each continental race carries within them, within their DNA.
Right. And the last kind of leg of evidence that they hold to is the haplogroups. But there's debate about how old those are, if they're as young as they tell us. There's debate if the way they trace those out into the mitochondrial Eve and Y chromosomal Adam are even accurate. I know there's a Russian scientist that claimed that he proved the European ones, mitochondrial distinct. Do you have any thoughts on the whole, this whole haplogroup thing and the fact they like to point to that as well, whatever the archaeological evidence says, well, we know it's wrong because we have these haplogroups that go back to Africa?
Well, yeah, I had seen, I think, the same story you did about a Russian team that confounded the out of Africa theory by looking at haplogroups and finding that there were certain haplogroups that the Africans had that no Europeans had. I mean, but I think that's just another way of understanding this graph that we've already examined here that shows these very deep divisions amongst even Africans that go back before we supposedly split off from one of those branches and went out into Europe and Asia, the rest of us. So, I mean, it's basically different ways, and we won't ever really know for sure until it's people who are race aware and are free of the restrictions put on them by Jews to tell the truth about it, that actually do this research and figure it out, just how deep the divisions are and what the actual story is. And they haven't done the same level of investigation in Africa, I think, because they are afraid to find out just how deep those divisions are. And they focused mainly on, I think, Europeans. Honestly, the scientists have done the most work looking at the DNA of Europeans. They know that's where the most interest is.
Right. Couple things I want to go there. First point, I don't know if this is true, but I've heard, I don't know if it's a law, if it's just a politically correct standard, but in Australia, they don't really do anything with the Abos. They don't do genetic studies on the Aboriginals.
Yeah, that's across the planet now. That's in due in part to Semitic correctness, that basically the native or indigenous peoples, and they never include Europeans in that, it's a word that means non-white, basically, are deferred to very strongly by scientists, and they flay themselves every time they try to study these peoples. And they, just out of curiosity, not because they're racialists, really, I believe a lot of them are just, they just want to see the great diversity of man, and they want to explore it, but they basically have to grovel to these primitive types and beg them for permission to please, may we take samples and please, may we publish the results. And they basically just flipped it on its head. In the past, the white man went in, did what he want, took his samples if he wanted, and then wrote about it back home in his university. And today they guilt trip themselves about that, and they're guilt tripped by Jews about that previous history. And so now they bend over backwards to show deference to these primitives, and it hinders science. And usually the only way that they can convince them to do it is by paying them money or making them promises about health or whatever other kind of results that they can, real tangible results that they can deliver, which is another, contradiction of the narrative that we talked about the last time you and I got together. This
race medicine.
Yeah, the racial differences, the genetic racial differences that actually lead to different efficacies of treatments, medicines amongst the different races. And that's medicines that are developed looking only at white people and that work fine on white people may not work on other types of people, and vice versa.
Yeah, I had an interesting experience a week ago. I went to my cardiologist and I was having an echo done, and at first I thought he looked kind of Jewish, but his accent was Eastern European, but we got to talking about genetics, and he sheepishly, because we were kind of talking, I let him know I was into that kind of stuff, he kind of sheepishly mentioned that they totally have to change doses in Japan because the system that processes it in the body is totally different, and things last longer in their bodies.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not surprised. Yeah, there's a lot of things I think even your general practitioner knows about racial differences. They have to know it. It's sort of like the political reality that all the politicians at a certain level of politics have to understand Jewish power because they can't survive very long without stepping on a landmine if they don't know about who they're not allowed to criticize and what they're not allowed to say. And it's the same thing with doctors, I think, and racial differences in medicine. They have to know those differences because they might get sued if they don't take them into account. What's controversial and what's okay is that it's okay to ignore those differences when it comes to white people. To, you know, in fact, white people complaining about it is just another thing to condemn white people for.
Well, I think he kind of hinted at how they're going to get around it. You know, we were talking about genetics and how bad it is that no one takes it into account and how things don't work as well. And he was saying, yeah, I can't wait till we have individualized genetic, you know, medicine. DNA testing individuals and for that one individual prescribing all their medication based on their DNA as an individual and not noticing how the patterns kind of lay out when you start to do that.
Yeah, sort of how like the white man has retreated into individual classical liberalism, individualism, yep, to at a political level to deal with the tribal warfare that the Jews are waging on us. It's except in medicine. Yeah, I see. I hadn't heard that, but yeah, it makes sense. And yeah, and euphemisms too. They'll just create new words for things that mean the same things as they used to mean. In this topic that we're talking about, instead of using the term race, they use population group.
Now, yeah, I love that. They'll say, oh, race doesn't exist. What we have is blah, blah, blah. They will literally say race doesn't exist, and then they'll go on to just describe what race is without the word. Like, literally, I've read articles. They're like, race doesn't exist. It's really about ancestry and phenotype. And it's like, well, that's what race means, you idiot.
Yeah, it's really about not getting the Jews upset at you so that you lose your job. Like,
yeah, well, speaking of God's chosen, this is related to the topic of genetics. What do you think of this weird phenomenon in Israel where they're really getting interested in DNA studies? They're wanting to map out their Y chromosome. They're making weird Aryan-looking babies that in vitro fertilization, artificial insemination is very popular in Israel, and they prefer blue-eyed, blonde-haired Nordic people for that.
There is no group of people on the planet that is more conscious or more has a stronger will to be racist, to misuse that term. I mean, race is just in the Jew narrative means white person being white, but they have a racial consciousness. They are hyper aware of who their ancestors are and who's married who and all of that. And things that you would call racist if you judged it, if you looked at it the right way, you know, and eugenics. That's another thing that they've practiced eugenics since long before there was any genetic understanding. It was just good animal husbandry, basically, breeding, and who breeds with who is of great concern to them. Their rules about, you know, who's a Jew, that the mother has to be a Jew herself in order for you to be a real Jew. Which in reality is that you both your mother and your father have to be a real Jew in order for you to be a real Jew. That's the real standard, the gold standard for Jews.
Well, yeah, and it's funny. The outer core of Judaism developed the matrilineal standard, I think, is a later adaptation in the diaspora, because if you actually read the Old Testament and the Tanakh, it's clearly patrilineal. And the priest class, the Kohanim, they give no credence to matrilineality. They're technically dual lineal. Because the Kohanim can only marry the daughters that are Kohanim. So the thing they're concerned with is the bloodline going back to, they say it's Aaron, Moses' brother, but I believe Aaron is actually a literary invention because they don't want to admit Moses, like any other cult leader, was probably sleeping with all of his followers.
Yeah. Well, the sense I make of the supposed conundrum between, you know, they talk about matrilineality in one place and patrilineality in others is that they're both true. Basically, like I said, the gold standard for a Jew being a Jew is that both their parents and all four grandparents and all their people going back are Jews, and that's you're a full member of the tribe when you can say that all your ancestors are Jews. They discourage conversion, even though they do take advantage of its products and mixing is, you know, but we talked about that the last time. We don't
need to get back to that. But no, I've noticed it seems like, you know, there's Jews. But it even seems within Jews, they make distinctions between themselves. And there is this kind of this new Kohanim gene that, from what I've read, they're really in Israel, really interested in tracing. And if you read their own mythology and I'm sure the rabbis are coming at this interpretation, only the people that, the men that carry that gene would be quote-unquote real Jews under the mythology. It's through the seed you shall be given the blessed nation.
Yeah, I hadn't seen that, but I am aware that there is a strange attraction amongst Jews, some Jews at least. They call them silver Jews, you know, these blonde Nordic Aryan looking Jews that I don't know. I just chalk it up to envy, you know, racial envy, that they are, generally speaking, hideous, ugly
creatures.
Yeah, the Negro.
They look like rats. Okay. But no, yeah, I was. I wish I could remember the lady's name. She did an interview with Red Ice, and she was talking about Israel's the number one user of in vitro fertilization, artificial insemination, because of all their damn genetic disorders. And when they have to do a donor, just like in South America, they like the blue-eyed, blonde-haired Nordic.
Yeah, that's a good point to make too. Is just that the Jews, they have no limits. No, there's no meta-Jew group basically telling the Jews that, no, you're not allowed to do this kind of stuff. So they go full bore. The genetics research and such is the Jews are not shy about doing that research to find out what is the source of our mental diseases and our other genetic diseases and trying to eradicate them. They have they've always had this informal thing about the matchmaking that would try and keep, you know, one particular line from crossing with this other line because it was known to produce bad results. But nowadays with genetics, they can basically get genetic tests for the groom and the bride and see if they're going to basically have two recessive genes come together and produce a bad babies. And so they, you know, encourage them to go marry someone else. But they suffer the limits that they force us to. But, you know, to an extent, we, the rest of us, are still free to do a certain amount of eugenics ourselves. And you see that kind of thing, that same thing that the Jews, you're saying the Jews do, which is when you have these sperm donor places and you can say what you want, you know, people of all races seem to want the tall, Nordic, blonde-haired, blue-eyed European, the ideal European look, and of course they want high IQ too, you know, somebody who's a hard-charging, wealthy aristocrat type. But that's, you know, throughout history, that's always been, there's our selective pressure has always been on, like any other animal, the most healthy-looking, you try to find and mate with the most healthy-looking mate you can get. It's just how nature works.
Yeah. No,
the Jews, the one other aspect would be that they need to blend in, you know, and a lot of their mixing was, if not deliberately for the purpose of mixing in, was at least sort of turning lemons into lemonade by using it. And the mixed product was more likely to serve the Jews. I've made that point many times in the past, that they tend to serve the Jew parasitism. They worm their way into positions of power in the Gentile society and then direct the resources of that Gentile society into protecting or funding, feeding the Jewish minority, the parasitic minority within it.
Yeah, oftentimes Mischlings can be more toxic than Jews. Tim Wise is a great example of that. It's a combination of having some of the stereotypical Jewish traits and some of whatever problems mixed people just tend to have.
Yeah, it's like the little bit of nerve agent that a mosquito injects, you know, when they inject you, the painkiller, so that you don't feel the fangs going in. That's what you can think of Mischlings as.
Yeah.
So anyway, we're getting a little off topic here. Let's get back to the main topic, which is us and our background, our history, our heritage. And the next diagram I have here just shows, I just want to touch on it quickly, this blob of the Amnaya in the center with arrows going into Germany and Northwestern Europe. And it's labeled corded ware. And this was, the graphs here says 5 to 6,000 years ago, and it shows another arrow going down into India. This was again, this was something that the evil Nazis suspected and talked about, and even people, racialists before the National Socialists came into existence, had sort of concluded this from archaeological evidence that they had found of this corded ware culture. They found all of these battle axe mounds with people that were different from the other remains that they had found underneath them. And they, you know, I think Cochrane talks about this quite a bit, that this battle axe culture, they saw this conquering people sweeping into Europe, wiping away the people that were there beforehand. This corded ware culture developed into the Belbeker people later. And then those Belbeker people spread into France and Spain and Britain and replaced many of the people, more so in Britain than they replaced in Spain. Again, that's the differences amongst modern day Europeans is the various levels of these components that they carry in them of these ancestors and where they come from. This culture that the Yamnaya carried into Europe, this corded ware culture and this conquering battle axe chariot riding culture, is, my own personal speculation is that it comes in large part from the A&E, that ancient North Eurasian group, and that they were especially warlike for that reason. I called it special sauce, their special ingredient earlier. I don't really have much to hang that on, except that they were otherwise racial cousins with the other Europeans, and the invasions didn't go the opposite direction. So what was it that made the Yamnaya, you know, get up out of their homelands and thrive so much in their homelands that they felt the pressure to go out and conquer everybody around them? And not just in Europe, they flowed into Europe, but then they also flowed eastward into India too.
Yeah, from what I've heard, there's a couple theories. There's a theory that the R1A, R1B Y chromosome is slightly statistically more likely to produce male offspring, so there may have been a gender disparity. That their chieftains may have also been polygamous, so the young men of the lower caste may not have had opportunities for mating, so that's why they kind of ventured out to conquer.
Thanks for reminding me. Yeah. R1B, the Y chromosome, there's several common types in modern Europeans. R1A and R1B are the two most common, and they're associated, both are associated with the Yamnaya, the Aryans. And people have speculated about that in the past, and it's pretty much confirmed now that that's who carried them into Europe. And there's also I1 and I2, or I1A and I1B. I forget what they're called now. And those are associated with the Western hunter-gatherers that were in Europe. And I forget what comes from the European farmers. Maybe R1A comes from the European farmers. I don't know. But I know I just read this while reviewing my understanding for this discussion with you, that R1B has been identified as coming not just from the Yamnaya, but from the A&E people. The R1B haplotype, Y chromosome, developed in the A&E people. They mixed with the Yamnaya, and then the Yamnaya carried it into Europe. So, and that's one of the most common Y chromosomes in Europe today, is variants on the R1B.
Yeah, I'm part of the R1B1 subclad. I can't remember the exact subclad, but it's R1B1 something.
Yeah, I'm R1 something or other. I don't recall whether it was A or B.
My understanding that A and B both are breakoffs from the Indo-Europeans, that there really isn't a Y chromosome left from the Neolithic farming people.
I think it was I, but I'm not certain of that. Maybe the I was.
I think it's hunter-gatherer. I think you're right. I think I is hunter-gatherer, and that's only found in Scandinavia.
I think that in parts of South the Balkans, South Europe, South Eastern Europe, I've also seen maps that show, you know, pools of I out there. I don't think nowhere is it the dominant. I don't think the dominant Y chromosome. You know, it's, but there are certain areas where it's more common than not. anyway, that's another, the thing, we could go into a long discussion of that, but basically these haplotypes, the Y chromosome is just one of the 23 chromosomes that we have, and it's actually kind of mutilated. It's there's not all that much that's, it carries the sexing of males. You know, the male is an X and a Y, the Y that he gets directly from his father, and you can trace it back to my father, got his from his father, who got it from his father, all the way back. And that's what it's useful for, is you look at the Y chromosome and you know you're looking at basically a genome that, or a subset of the genome that has not been disturbed by anything except mutations. It's either, you either pass it down to your kids, or some other man passes it down to your kids, you know, that you've been cuckolded. It doesn't cross with the mother at all. And the mother has a similar bit of genetics called the mtDNA, which is the mitochondrial DNA, which is similar. It's a small amount of DNA that only mothers pass on to their daughters, and so on and so on. I forget the technical term for it, but it's basically, if you think of your ancestors as a pyramid extending back into the past behind you or above you, that, you know, the mother's genes go up one side of that pyramid, the father's genes and the father's genes go up the other side. Those are the uniparental genetics. But the vast bulk of our genes, what they call the sort of nuclear DNA, or from the other 23 chromosomes, is from both parents. And that's where you do get the mixing, roughly 50-50 mixing of mother and father. And there, you know, that's where these plots of, you know, how much percentage of Yamnaya versus Western hunter-gatherer versus early farmer come from, is they're looking at the whole DNA there, all the chromosomes, not just the Y or haplotypes and the maternal haplotypes, or I don't even know what their names are, what the most common ones are.
I think H is the most common in Europe. I think H, I know it's H. I can't remember if there's a particular subgroup that's most common. I know I'm H3C.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't recall what mine is. So what's interesting, here's an interesting point that I realized I wanted to bring up, is this graph about the migrations of the Yamnaya, right? The where the Aryans came from and where they went to is something that has been a controversial issue ever since World War II. The recent DNA discoveries have kind of nailed it down to, yeah, they came from this area of modern-day Ukraine and a little bit to the east of there, not from Anatolia, which was the other competing hypothesis. And the point is that this was considered controversial, and it was only 5,000-6,000 years ago, right? Relatively recent history. But out of Africa, they know that for sure, even though that happened at least 10 times as long ago. And that's the very next image, is this a depiction of what the current modern contemporary out of Africa theory is, with its little arrows about who migrated where and when. And this, it is considered controversial by fair-minded scientists when discussing this. They all admit that this is guesswork, but it fits the evidence as best they can. But my point is, it's not really controversial to show this second map. The first map is taboo. It's talking about the Yamnaya. And even though that's already a euphemism for Aryan, the Jews know that that's Aryans. The Jews know that this is who the Nazis idolized and talked about. And they're worried in these articles that they write about David Reich's work is, you know, oh my God, is this going to rekindle an interest in the Nazis and the Aryans? So there's that. But also the dates on this out of Africa map are telling, again, the fact that we Homo sapiens, quote unquote, left Africa 150 to 200,000 years ago now. So that's the big difference that we were talking about early on in this conversation, that it's not the 40 to 45,000 years ago that they used to say. It's now three or four times that. And that's when we started speciating from each other. So the people who left Africa, all of us are at least 150 to 200,000 years different, distinct from, speciated from Africans. And then amongst those other major arrows, you can see we all went our separate ways at various points in the past, which matches what you can see with your own eyes, what the racialists looked at, just looking at bones, taking measurements of skulls 100, 150 years ago. They could see that this was basically the differences. They didn't, what the difference is, they thought more highly of the multi-regional hypothesis back then than they did about this idea that we all started in one place. We all had to have started in Africa because we're all Africans. And they didn't put that requirement on it. They could see that these various peoples were more similar or more distinct from each other. And they had this basic, you could call it a hierarchy, but a tree basically of when these peoples must have started to speciate from each other. And that, for instance, the Amerindian types had been a recent, that were similar enough to the Mongoloids in Asia that you could see that they were related, they were more closely related to each other than either of them were to Europeans. Right. And that's borne out by the recent DNA evidence too.
Yeah, some companies, like for the over-the-counter DNA, try desperately to keep those categories separate, but 23andMe, which actually is supposed to have one of the biggest bases, they lump them together. I mean, they have them as sub-branches, but they admit if it's under a certain percentage, they can't quite distinguish between Native American and Asian.
They can't distinguish? Well, they can. I mean, in this part...
They can. But with the way they do it over the counter, just looking at the handful of parts of the genes that they look at, if it's a tiny enough admixture, they'll tell you it could be East Asian, could be Native American.
Yeah, and the point is that the confusion is in the fine gradations. And that makes sense, because the more subtle the distinction, the genetic distinction gets, the more closely related the peoples are, the less important the differences are, the less life-threatening they are. This is all of a piece with what we've already discussed, how, you know, eventually the differences get to be so extreme that you can physically no longer produce viable offspring with a group once it's speciated far enough from your own. What I was maybe jumping the gun at there a little is basically, you know, we're talking about some subtle differences here, especially amongst Europeans, that picture of with the orange and the blue and the green components, they, when looking very closely at the genetics, they can see the differences between those three groups in various mutations. Now, were those groups significantly different from each other? Yeah, they were probably slightly different in appearance and had slightly better adaptations to different things. Maybe I'm not sure if the Amnaya were lactose tolerant or not. I think that the farmers, the early farmers, that was one of the things that they had that gave them the advantage.
No, I think it's the other way around. I think it's that the Yamnaya, the Aryans, were lactose tolerant, and they think that they were able to conquer is because they had like an unlimited supply of calories.
Right. Yeah. So they were able to bring their animals with them and not just use them for food directly by killing them, but they could also milk them and drink their milk for energy. Yeah, I think you're right. Now that I recall, but you know, the point being that even I'm not contradicting myself here. I'm trying to get at, you know, somebody who might criticize and say, you're saying that there's only minor differences, but then you're saying that even minor differences can be significant. Yeah, that's right. That's basically what I'm trying to say, is that amongst the components that make up modern Europeans, they're certainly relative to the other peoples on the planet. The differences were small, very small compared to those differences with other peoples. And yet, even a single, what they call it, SNP, a single nucleotide polymorphism, a single letter in your 2 billion letter DNA can make a life or death difference about something like, I don't know if lactose tolerance is a single SNP, but there are other things, other mutations that are, you know, it's literally a single edit that, here's a good one out of recent news about AIDS not immunity. Yeah, I think it is an immunity. If you have inherited from both your mother and your father, this single letter mutation in your, in certain, some part of your DNA having to do with your immune system. And it's, this is only found in Northern Europeans. Then you are basically immune to AIDS. And this was, you know, shocking. It's another racial difference, but it just demonstrates the absolute life and death difference that a single little difference in DNA can make. And it's a racial
about that. I think it was a mitochondrial mutation that gave you a certain degree of a resistance to the AIDS virus. I think it actually was mine. I think when I was researching my H subtype, that's actually one of the weird, unique things about it.
Well, it came out of the news about this CRISPR modification, the CRISPR babies in China, that some Chinese scientist had edited a girl or a pair of girl twins. I forget what the details are, but the kind of lost in the details of the story was that he didn't just use CRISPR and modify these babies, but he did a very specific thing. He gave them this Northern European mutation that makes them immune to AIDS. And that got lost in the shuffle, except amongst, you know, people like me who, you know, saw it and filed it away in my head. I'm glad I remembered it for this particular example. But it's not found in all Northern Europeans. It's just a more frequent, it's only present in Europeans, and it's more frequent in Northern Europeans than it is in non-Europeans. And it's one of those things also where if both your parents have it, you're immune. If one parent has it, it just gives you a kind of partial immunity to it. So again, the point is that, yes, even a single little difference can be life or death. And yet, as far as compatibility goes, and this is something that the early Americans understood in their, you know, before it turned into a melting pot polyglot, the country and its immigration policies, is they understood that there were certain types of peoples that were closely related, the Northern Europeans, that it didn't matter if you let a few Frenchmen into your country and or a few Dutch or a few Danes or whatever, that they were all basically the same kind of people and they would assimilate. And they were right because race is real. And those peoples of Northwestern Europe were fairly homogenous genetically. They may have had distinctions amongst their languages to the point where they couldn't understand each other linguistically, but genetically and culturally, they produced very similar civilizations and societies. And so they could blend into one to create a new thing in America. And it's when you start trying to introduce Southern Europeans and North Africans and Middle Easterners and Congoids from sub-Saharan Africa and South Pacific Islanders, when you throw all of them into the mix is when you get the sort of Frankenstein monster that is being created today.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned compatibility. The compatibility issues don't just occur between the major continental races, but even the subcategories. I wish I had the article on hand, but I remember listening to a podcast where it was talked about. There can be problems. I can remember certain conditions. To get a donor, you have to that donor has to be the exact same mix because it has to do with things in the immune system. The genetic markers have to be the same. There are certain problems. I think it was like leukemia, where even a person who's a mix of Northwestern European and Southern European or Northwestern European and Eastern European, I think was actually specifically the example given, can have a hard time finding a match.
Yeah, for bone marrow transplants or other organ transplants, especially blood-related, and that's why the organ transplants, it's critical to do matching, and genetic matching is the best family. You know, somebody who's got the same blood type in the same family is the best donor. But that's why organs are related. A related topic is because they're all fed by blood, you know, so they're, and especially bone marrow, which produces the blood to begin with. But you're absolutely right. The even subtle differences there can be life and death. If you transplant the wrong blood, and one of the things I learned when I investigated blood typing is that what the ordinary person understands is the ABO kind of stuff and positive and negative. What they don't realize is that there's a lot of other more subtle factors than that, and that they still continue to discover, between the peoples.
Yeah, the Antigens. I don't know if you saw it, but there were some, it's in the UK, some outfit that was trying to get people to donate blood. I had a picture of a black girl, maybe she was a mulatto, and saying, we need more African donors. And the comment section was a bunch of white liberals, and probably some Jews, chimping out and saying, oh, well, as long as the blood type matches, it doesn't matter. And each time, politely, the company had to explain, no, for certain conditions such as leukemia, antigen markers matter, they do with the immune system, and it needs someone from a specific ethnic group.
Yes, antigens that lay people don't know about. I mean, I don't know, remember the names either. It's kind of esoteric knowledge. But what I do remember is that they are life and death, and that they, for organ transplants and especially bone marrow, it's so particular that when you have race mixed people who need those things, they're basically shit out of luck because there is nobody else like them that has their mix of whatever their mother is and whatever their father is that is compatible. Even their mother and their father are different enough from them that they can't take a donor. They can't use either of them as a donor. Their siblings are different enough that they can't be donors. Yeah,
because the mix never comes out the same. I hope he doesn't mind me telling the story because he's told it live on air. But Kaiser Wayne, I've talked to him a few times. He's white, castizo from Mexico, but his cousin is a mestiza, and she married an Irish guy. And their kid has got leukemia, and they can't find a match. Siblings aren't a match. Mom's not a match. Dad's not a match. Because the mix came out in just such a unique way, even in the mixed hellhole of Mexico, they can't find someone who's the exact flavor. Because really, there's three major components. The dad was Irish, so like pure Northwestern European. The mom is mestizo, so probably a general mix of Amerindian and Southern European, and probably even some Middle Eastern thrown in there for good measure. So probably a unique mix that doesn't exist in anyone else on this planet.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're so few people that it's hard to find a match. You know, it's just about the size of the pool of potential donors. It's, you know, once you start getting really small, it's hard to, you know, even get in contact with them. But that's that, back to that individualized medicine thing. You know, once they have everybody's DNA on record, they can call you up in the middle of the night and say, you know, we've got an offer here for you for X, whatever, X amount of money if you want to be a donor. But that's really just all getting around the reality. The racial reality is that you know, when you mix together people who are so speciated that you get these problems that require solutions. Norman, let's take a break. All right. I got to use the men's room.
Okay. That sounds good. I will, you can mute your mic and I'll actually put on some music.
All right, back in a few minutes.
Okay. Open a new tab here on YouTube.
Recalls the salt marshes, the woodland funeral pyres. a tyrant spell, cold tide of evil swamping the land, drowning our people. Tyrant spell cast in the east, we are the victims of the dark sea. The halls of the mighty filled with traitors and liars. They think we are cattle to be butchered for their fires. We are the people of light, trampled in the dirt. The pain you feel inside is a blood memory of hurt. A tyrant spell, cold tide of evil, swamping the land, drowning our people. Tyrant spell, cast in the east, we are the victims of the dark sea. A tyrant spell, cold tide of evil, swamping the land, drowning our people. We of the winter, we of the fall, we are a lost tribe, we must heed the call. Out in the dust lands, the fowl move with stealth. They have all the power, they have all the wealth.
The message is going to be part of the cause of the transformation, which must take place. Europe is now the very part of the global project. And I think we're going to be part of the cause of the transformation, which must take place. Europe is now the very part of the global project. And I think we're going to be part of the cause of the transformation, which must take place. Europe is now the very part of the global project. And I think we're going to be part of the cause of that. Transformation, which must take place. Europe is not yet very much. And I think we're going to be part of the cause of that transformation, which must take place. Europe is not.
Dan, are you back?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay.
I'm just scanning through some of the comments that have been made so far. I see there was one I wanted to answer. Somebody said, why isn't he sharing his screen? You know, I prepared to, and I know how to, but and I did want to show it for some of these graphs. And, you know, but one thing I thought is our previous conversation has already been removed from YouTube. I don't know how long ago that was, but it won't.
Uploaded. I've downloaded it to my computer and I re-upload it to my different channels and move it around.
Oh, cool. All right. Well, I was going to say, you know, it's kind of, I've always been an audio guy anyway, and I keep the images to a minimum, but they are important this time around. So let me see about sharing so people can see what it was we were talking about. I know it's a little late, but it better.
Yeah. And everything is permanent on BitChute. My first interview with you is on BitChute. Like I said, I have it, I think, on all four of my YouTube channels. And I put everything in private when I get a strike to avoid getting the third and final strike. And I mess around. I've been censored so many times by these damn Jews.
Right. And the person who said, why isn't he sharing his screen? He's probably 50. They are right about that. But... there. Can you see this?
Yes, I can.
All right. So I don't know if that's visible to everybody else. But anyway, this is the page. The other thing is I thought people would be at their computers listening to this, mostly the ones listening live. So here's the first one we were talking about, hominid versus hominin. This is a Khoisan hunter-gatherer African. The most different from Europeans of the people on the planet right now, if you want to call them people. That's what they use to represent our branch. And then this one, I think this is probably the most important of all the images I posted, this one here. Is this visible to you guys?
Yes, and I have you presenting, so your even when I'm talking, your screen will remain the dominant one for the viewer.
All right, cool. So, like I said, this is, I think, the most important one. This is the one that kind of gives an overview of everything, the ancientness of this hominin, even if you do want to call this whole thing us. It shows how far back the branchings, the speciation within it go. It shows the major branches of Neanderthal and Denisovan. And it shows down here, this is the modern, the hominins that still are alive and what where they branched off from each other. And these are the three branches that are still in Africa. And then here's this mixing within the racial cousins that we've been talking about, the Aryans and the Western. This is the A&E, the Aryans, the Western hunter-gatherer, and the early European farmers. So like I said, I think the most important one. This is an interesting one in that it just shows the various mixture of Aryan within the different European peoples and how it fits what the old-time Nordicists used to think, which is that the Northern Europeans were the basically the strongest descendants of the Aryans. That's borne out by the DNA.
Yeah, and I don't know if you want to get into that discussion, but you know, I've heard different speculations on what makes of these three ancestral components what makes us. Of course, our tendency is to admire the Aryans because they had many admirable traits. But of course, Kevin McDonald's theory is, you know, I don't believe in the pathological altruism aspect. But he maintains a lot of our personality traits actually more come from the hunter-gatherers. And I've heard people argue that actually our technical ability more comes from the Neolithic farmers, because those are the same stock of people who later on would go to build Egypt and in ancient times built Stonehenge. The kind of
Yeah, I hadn't heard that before. But and I'm just realizing this now, but McDonald's theory is based on the assumption that Europeans are a very large part still old hunter-gatherer types, whereas what that graph shows is that we're, especially in the north, the ones that he thinks are the most notoriously pathologically altruistic, the Scandinavian types, are actually more than half or about half Aryan. And the Aryans are the people whose personality is the most warlike in our known history, or at least our mythology. And actually there's evidence for it now. This, like I said, the battle axe culture is basically Aryan.
Yep. Yeah, I don't know if you saw, but I did a video addressing pathological altruism, and I made the point that it's not altruism that's the trait that's being described. It's conformity, that hunter-gatherers living in a poor resource environment would quickly learn not to rock the boat. They would develop a very conformist mentality. So it's more pathological conformity, pathological virtue signaling, if you feel the need to use pathology to describe whites, than it is any kind of altruism.
Yeah, I watched that video. It was very good. You did a good job there. And I would also make the point that pathology implies that there's a pathogen. There's an agent that is causing the problem, and that if you remove that agent, then the pathology would go away. And that's the point that I think many of the people, not to Kevin McDonald so much, but many of the people who bring up pathological altruism as an explanation for what's going on, they just want to basically talk about how white people are doing this to ourselves, and that there isn't anybody else playing a role. Nobody else has agency, that there is no tribe of Jews that are actually controlling the media and very actively pursuing their own interests and manipulating us.
Yeah.
So that was this is the last image that we talked about of the out of Africa, the modern, contemporary, updated with new dates out of Africa diagram. And we might as well move on to this one here. I don't want to spend too much time again for the same reason we didn't talk about Asians in too much depth. This is about focused on Africans. This is from a paper that did do a little bit of genetic analysis on Africans, and this is what they found. It's not just three branches of Africans, it's five, And you see here again, the speciation goes back. The most recent, here's this little elbow here, is everybody else on the planet besides Africans branched off from Africans, according to this diagram, only 110,000 years ago, or sorry, it's less, 75,000 years ago or so, maybe 80, according to this graph. And you see how small we are in the scheme of things here. And it's really these all of these African populations that is the focus of this study. But even they're differentiated from each other, speciated from each other by 250, almost 300,000 years separated from each other. And these are the Khoisan over here, this branch. So that's the point I wanted to make about this particular graph and genetic diversity inside Africa, the amongst the hominins that never left Africa and now are getting on airplanes built by the white man and flying elsewhere. Never invented the wheel, but they can get on an airplane.
Yeah, if there's anything we can blame ourselves for, it's, well, I mean, we didn't give them our technology. The Jews have kind of taken our technology for us, but, you know, I have a hard time believing. I mean, I know the Jews ran the slave trade, but I have a hard time believing that. Why didn't our ancestors just look at these creatures and be like, no, these people have to go, zero contact, quarantine. These things can never be allowed to have our level of civilization.
Yeah, well, as recently as 1939, Charles Lindbergh wrote a paper basically saying as much. He said, you know, he was one of the pioneers of aviation and said the white man should not be sharing this kind of technology with the other races of the planet. He, never mind Africans. He didn't want to share it with the Asians because he saw that they were, you know, potential competitors. And he was ignored and shouted down. A lot of people, you know, basically looked up to him, and a lot of people thought the same thing he did. But ultimately, you know, that's what World War II was about, you know. The white race was tricked and bribed and through their own greed was fought a war against itself and lost. And the Jews won that conflict. And men like Charles Lindbergh today are, you know, it's just a matter of time before they finally get around to, you know, making him into a non-person, just like they've done to James Watson right now in real time. The Jews all know, and this whole America First thing with Trump sort of brings it back up into the contemporary mainstream awareness that Charles Lindbergh was one of the high profiles that was behind the America First movement in you know, the years before World War II to try and keep America out of the European conflict. And that's one reason why Charles Lindbergh is you know, demonized by Jews today. Although he was such an icon and such a hero that they have trouble, just like with Henry Ford and other famous racialists that maybe did something else besides their racialism. They have trouble trashing them, but they'll get around to them eventually. So this next image is contemporary anthropologists, and this is how they try to virtue signal, to signal to the Jews that they've gotten the message and they know how to parrot it about racism. Yeah, race may be, there's no biological racist basis for race, the first one says, but racism is real. And so this is that contradiction that you were referring to earlier, where the people who are most responsible for making sense of the information about our origins and about our differences are ideologically biased to believe this Jew bullshit that race doesn't actually have a biological basis, that it's, or whatever biological differences there are, aren't significant, that it's the real problem. And the real cause of all the problems in the world is racism. And of course, they won't be honest that racism really just means white people being white. And, you know, here, other than maybe the one or two of them that are Jews, these look like white people. They are just parroting the current regime's religious tenets.
Yeah, it's funny, and kind of I've made the point before that the coalition of the angry brown people does not hold together well because the narrative clash. I don't know if you saw it, but with the Elizabeth Warren crap, there was a Native American woman who wrote an article basically saying she got into that, the idea of, you know, white people claiming insignificant amounts of Native American ancestry and how that's wrong. But she also talked about how this out of Africa narrative, this we're all human, the race mixing nigger race narrative, this is offensive to Native Americans, that she was saying that it is an attempt to undermine their indigenousness. So she didn't appreciate white liberals throwing around, oh, we're all human, we all come out of Africa.
Yeah, well, the glue that holds together all these disparate non-white peoples who are as different from each other as they are from white people, the glue that holds them together is whites being their enemy, or whites identifying whites as the enemy. The thing about us versus them tactics that the Jews constantly write articles decrying white people for having us versus them thinking is real, and it really works. You know, when you have control over the media, and that's who really has the whip hand to use that tactic, then you can define who is us and who is them, and what's allowed for us to do to them, what we should do to them. And they've identified white people as the them, that it's okay to insult, it's okay to attack, it's okay to demonize and kill and jail for trying, you know, for behaving badly. You know, racism, white people trying to do white things is just racist. And the coalition, you're right, once it's put under any sort of stress, it starts to fight amongst itself. It starts to fly apart. But what's holding it together is Jews that have, you know, micromanaging. That's why they have to be part of it. You know, they don't want to be excluded from the women's march, because they need to be there orchestrating it. They need to be there making sure that it doesn't like turn against the Jews at some point, which it's, there's some threat. I think they overblow it. But, you know, basically, because Jews pose as white people, and they also at the same time spew all of this anti-white rhetoric about white privilege and white power and white racism, there's a conflict, a narrative clash, as you called it. That's what I call it, too, of a clash of Jew narratives, that the Jews are different from whites, and yet they are seen as white by these other non-whites, by Asians and Amerindians and mestizos and so forth, and that they resent this white person telling them what they can and can't do and what they should or shouldn't do. And as soon as the Jew is accused of being white and having white privilege, well, that's when, you know, the Jew throws off the white mask and says, oh, no, I'm not white. I'm a Jew. And you can't do that. You know, because it's a... that's a sin. When you attack a Jew, that's anti-Semitism. That's even worse than racism.
Right, right. And it's funny, you know, for a long time, the leftist criticism of Israel, they tried to mask it under, oh, Israel is a white supremacist state. But I'm noticing more and more of the non-whites on the left are getting braver, criticizing Israel and criticizing Zionism without saying, oh, it's just a form of white supremacy. They're just criticizing it as itself without qualifying it. Not that I'm saying, you know, we need to ally with non-whites against the Jews. I just think it's funny that they put themselves in this predicament.
Yeah, it's inevitable. Yeah. Because that's the reality of it, the Jews aren't white. They don't think of themselves as white. They see, and they'll tell you, I mean, all you have to do is listen to their narrative about the Holocaust, about the blood libel, about the expulsions, about the expulsion from Spain, the expulsion from Egypt. All of this stuff is basically just saying, you know, white people are our enemy and have been our enemy throughout history. And, you know, they paint it from their point of view that they're the victims of white hostility, when, of course, the reality from our point of view is that they've been the interlopers and the ones imposing themselves upon Europeans, which is another point I want to bring up, as long as we're back to talking about the Jews again. And the distinction between Jews and whites is this long history of whites goes back 40,000 years ago, or if you want to make it more recent, more solid, it's, say, 6,000 years ago. There were no Jews in Europe until about 2,000 years ago. And, you know, Khazar theory aside, that the Jews are actually, or the Ashkenazi Jews are actually like some mid-Asian, or, you know, actually, ironically enough, from the same area that the Yamnaya, their homeland is, in the modern-day Ukraine and east of Ukraine, that is supposedly the kingdom of Khazaria, where a bunch of Khazarians, Turkic people, converted to Judaism and became the modern Ashkenazi. The jury's out on that. I don't care one way or the other how it turns out. I can see, though, from the genetic evidence in this last graph here that I attached to this post, was the DNA of various types of Jews, Middle Easterners, and some Europeans. And you can see that the red section here in the middle is where the Ashkenazis cluster, in between various Europeans like the French, Lithuanians, Russians, up here, Hungarians, Romanians, and even the Sardinians and Spaniards. Something to say about Sardinians in a second, but that they're sort of halfway in between, almost like Mischlings are halfway in between pure Europeans and pure Jews. The Jews themselves, the Ashkenazi Jews, in this graph at least, are displayed as halfway between the Middle Easterners who stayed in the Middle East and Europeans.
Right, and they're closer to Southern Europeans than they are Northwestern Europeans.
Yeah. Now, the point about the Sardinians is, of the mixes in people, let me go back to the graph here to make this point of these various mixtures of components. I think Sardinians are in here. Yeah, Sardinians, last one. They've got the most of that early European farmer. In fact, people like Cochrane, contemporary scientists who are talking fairly openly about this prehistory that genetics is unveiling, describe Sardinians. They say, if you want to know what the early European farmers that came into Europe 7,000 to 9,000 years ago looked like and were like genetically, Sardinians are the best proxy for them that we have. And it makes sense that they moved in, they occupied Sardinia, and they basically then had a moat around them ever since. And so they've suffered very little of subsequent mixing. Unlike
in terms of the attempts to kind of categorize the early farmer, the Neolithic farmer, as proto-Semitic?
Could be. One graph I saw, I didn't add it to my thing here, but I think it's in that slideshow that that pair of slides that this one comes from, displayed another line that had Ashkenazi Jews as even more farmer than Sardinians are. I mean,
yeah, I'd like to see if you could send the link to that.
There's to see if I can find it again. I take anything about the Jews and genetics, I take with a grain of salt, because for the most part, you've got Jews doing that science, and they've been known to distort the truth. I mean, basically, they're a tribe of liars. And even in this field where people can double check, they can, I think, take part in the fact that most scientists, even if they found a discrepancy, if they tried to reproduce the results and found a discrepancy, they wouldn't dare contradict, you know, a Jew researcher on the topic. So, like I say, I take anything about them with a grain of salt, but it did show that they were more farmer, and farmer in loose terms, because the thing we know about Jews also is that they're not farmers culturally.
Except
maybe farmers of farmers. They're meta farmers. You know, I think it was Ford's International Jew book, whoever the author was that wrote that, made the point that, civilized man is a farmer and an agriculturalist, and Jews are farmers of men, and especially in the Pale, in the Soviet Union, before the Soviet Union was the Soviet Union, the Jews were especially exploitative of farmers there. They acted as a sort of predator on the farmers, extending them loans, and then when the season went bad, you know, when their crop went bad, that they would have to declare, they would basically lose their property. I was about to say declare bankruptcy, but I don't even know if it was that formal back then. It was just basically, sorry, you lost your farm. And that's how the Jews came into a lot of their riches, those kind of schemes.
Yeah.
Farming men, farming people.
Yeah, now before we get off the topic of Jew genetics, I don't know if you're familiar with it. It was a study from, I believe, 2012, maybe 2014. I can't remember if it was done through genetic archaeology or just through artificial graphs in a lab, but they now speculate that the original Levantians were more similar to modern-day Europeans than the people currently in the Middle East because of genetic displacement events, the Arab invasion, which brought in North African Negro-type genetics, and then the Mongol invasion. So do you think the Jews that first came into Europe would have been full-blown Arabs as we know today, or do you think they would have been more like Mediterranean-type people?
The Jews that first came in during the Roman times in 2000 years? I really don't know. I hadn't heard that, but it sounds reasonable to me that basically this is a point we made earlier, that the people living in an area today are not necessarily related to the people who lived there 10,000, 5,000, you know, whatever, however long ago, because of these migrations and replacements, conquests in the past. So it's... And as far as I know, tracing back the history and other posts where I focused on, you know, the history of the Jews, where did the Jews come from? What are the Jews? You know, sort of a related but separate topic from what we're discussing tonight, is their history traces back about 3,000 years ago, maybe the first 2,500 years ago that you see the ancient historians and geographers of the day already starting to talk about the Jews as being very powerful and present in all the urban commercial centers. I think the most early reference I made, I did a post on Jew slaving 6 months or so ago, that there was an island called Elephantine, a city on an island in the Upper Nile, where the Jews had situated themselves, early Jews. These would have been like the proto-Jews, or one subset of them. Between the Egyptian Empire at the time and the Egyptian whatever it was, kingdom, and the sub-Saharan Africans further to the south, and that they had set themselves up as middlemen, as traders along this and probably as slavers too, on this island. And that is probably the earliest evidence of the Jews, and that it goes along with the evidence of them as slavers, that is their profession. From the mists of time, as far back as we know them. So what their biological roots are, I don't think anybody knows. Probably there are some Jew geneticists who are digging into that right now, or who already have, and know more about it. And maybe we can talk about that another time when some of that's published, if it ever is.
Yeah, and another thing, I don't know if you saw it. Are you aware of a company called Living DNA?
Doesn't ring a bell.
It's an over-the-counter DNA testing site, but it actually does not include an Ashkenazi category. Let me see if I can find the damn link. So instead, when an Ashkenazi Jew goes and gets their DNA done, it actually gives them a breakdown, and it's basically a hodgepodge of different crap. I put the link in the chat, and I'll put it in the side chat here so you can see it. Two different people posted the results from Living DNA. This one guy, he claims, he's fully Jewish. He posted his results from Family Tree DNA, which says he's 99% Ashkenazi. Living DNA breaks that down as 65.8% European, that being 3.1% Southern European, 8.1% Europe Northwest, 4.6% Europe East, Near East, 27.2% of that 16% Levant, 6.6% South Turkey, 2% Iranian, 1.3% Arabian, 1.2% North Africa. Then they, for some reason, break Central Asia out as a separate category. So Northwest Caucasian, 3.9%, Chechnya, 1.1%, South Asia, 2%.
Yeah, this is curious. I hadn't seen this before. Thanks for the link. This reminds me of like the difference between reading the Jews media in the U.S. aimed at the Goyim and then going to the Israeli media outlets or the media outlets aimed at Jews, where you read the real story. Yes, I guess we could talk a little bit here about 23andMe and make a couple of points that, and this is something you can talk about with your normie friends. You say, wow, did you know that Ashkenazi Jew shows up in 23andMe results? I mean, that's weird, isn't it? A religion showing up in your DNA? But you see, and this is true, I think, that it that's even a dumbed down version of the reality. The reality is that Ashkenazi Jews actually can be broken down further into their various components, that most of which lies, and what differentiates them from Europeans especially, it's somewhere in the Middle East. You know, that's the peoples that they're more similar to genetically.
Yeah, and I mean, you could break it down even further, and this guy even does. He breaks it down through some of his Gidmatch things, and if I remember correctly, he was like overwhelmingly farmer on his Gidmatch. Whereas I, a northern Western European, I remember one Gidmatch calculator calculated me as much as 43.something% hunter-gatherer.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a second guy, a second Jewish guy that uploads his results from Living DNA. If you scroll down, he's a little bit wider. He's 70% European, and for some reason, most of his is Northwestern European. And then he's got, you know, also about the same amount of Levant, 16.2% Levant.
Yeah, well, they're mixed. You know, this is why a lot of racialists in the past and even today, and they're right, say that the Jews really aren't a race. It doesn't make sense to call them a race. They're more like a tribe of criminals. They do have a lot of, in one sense, they have a lot of genetic diversity in that you could, you know, break them down into these different pie charts of different components, just like with Europeans. But there is a certain thing that kind of doesn't jibe with this, which is this, you know, the typical black hat, Orthodox, Haredim, Jew, you know, the, Chabad type, davening, I think they call it that bobbing back and forth that they do, that the weird behaviors, the weird look to them and the inbredness of them. There's this, you know, something that doesn't jibe with this mix, unless the mix is pretty old, is that there is a certain homogeneity to them. There is a certain inbreeding in the main gene pool, in the very core of Jews.
Right. No, yeah. The whole they're not a race thing. It's like, okay, if you want to be really autistic, insist that race is the same thing as subspecies and only a phenotypically distinct group constitutes its own race. Well, we can at least agree that Ashkenazi Jews or just Jews in general constitute some kind of sub-race.
Yeah, well, or a racial group, racial, you know, an adjective of they have racial characteristics. Even the Jews admit they created this euphemism called ethnicity, which is really just a finer grained
of race.
And they admit that Jew is an ethnicity, which means, you know, speaks the same language and worships the same religion. And even though that's not true about Jews either, really, different groups of Jews speak different languages. And you know, if you look into Jewish religion, you find out which religion is Judaism. You know, there's actually mutually incompatible sects of Jewing, and especially the agnostic or atheistic Jew, which doesn't even make a pretense of believing in any particular religion. Well, fascinating link there. I'll save that one and delve into it in more detail another time. So there was one other thing I think you and I had discussed maybe getting to. It's a fairly big topic, but I think we have time to broach it if you're willing to and want to talk about it, which is CRISPR.
CRISPR, yeah, let's get into that.
Okay, CRISPR, as I described to you in our email back and forth arranging this conversation, is very interesting. It's a recent development, and it's interesting because it's where the war that the Jews have been waging using narrative against science, where the rubber meets the road in that war, where science can fight back and demonstrate that science trumps narrative. And the reason for that is because CRISPR is basically a tool. It's a gene editing technology that is fairly simple and cheap to use. It doesn't take a giant multi-million dollar laboratory to create or to make use of CRISPR. The recent story about the Chinaman who edited some genes in some babies is just the beginning of what's going to become possible, even for somebody working out of their garage in America, some white racialist, to be able to do if not right now, then very shortly. And the establishment, the regime, is very nervous about this. They've gone kind of radio silent about it, but 2 years ago or so, when CRISPR first started to break into the mainstream, every other article about it, you know, one article would be about the technical aspects of it and what it could do and what it promised and everything, and about potential cures for diseases. And then every other article would be about the potential use as a bioweapon, a targeted, a genetically targeted bioweapon, and how, oh no, how do we prevent this from happening? And this is the chickens coming home to roost, I guess, finally, that it makes it possible. What CRISPR is, you can think of it as a word processor, like for genes, where you can search for a given pattern of genes, and then somewhere, I don't know this, I'm a little fuzzy on this, how far away the part that you want to match from the part that you want to modify can be, but they are two separate things. So you can basically give it a targeting mechanism, and you can give it a strip of DNA to edit, to put in there instead, to substitute or to knock out. What this Chinese doctor did is he just did a simple knockout, because that's the most reliable thing that the current technology is capable of doing, making a single SNP, whatever, single nucleotide polymorphism, a knockout, they call it. You can think of it intuitively, it makes sense. If you just need to go in there and poke out one little thing, you could be much more precise about it than if you want to like take out this complicated bit and put in a different complicated bit to fix some more complicated genetic disease. So this is interesting from this aspect. Most of the talk about CRISPR is focused, for semantically correct reasons, on, and because people are interested in and only think really about these good uses of it, of, are these quote unquote good, of fixing genetic problems. They know that there are certain things that are encoded into our genes, and if we could just modify the genes in all of the cells in our body, then we would magically cure ourselves of those diseases. I don't know any off the top of my head, but there are at least, you know, whatever, a bunch of them that are fairly simple, that would be fairly simple to change. And so there's a lot of discussion, too, about the ethics of doing this, because CRISPR, you can use it as a genetic treatment, as there have been for a long time, genetic modification of yourself and your problem. But where it's really kind of revolutionary is that you can also use it to edit the germ cells in your body, the sperm and the eggs, which means that when you then make babies, you will be passing that modification that you've made to yourself, or that a doctor has made to you, onto your next generation. And that's also where it becomes kind of a bioweapony, although, you know, you could think of the bioweapon application for it as applying to just individuals right here and now. But if you could do it insidiously, use it more as a stealthy weapon, you would infect people and they wouldn't even know that they had a problem. It would just be in their offspring or their lack of ability to make offspring that they would see it. I think when it comes to the Jews and what kind of weapon would work against them based on CRISPR or any other gene editing technology, it would have to be something that takes immediate effect, because they have the upper hand as far as the access to potential labs that would potentially create a cure or a defense against whatever weapon you might imagine. But let me give you a chance to share your thoughts a bit about it before I go a little deeper into this.
Yeah, no, I've looked into this, and I think it could be a possible solution. We'll get into the applications of that in a second. But just for anyone that maybe is freaked out, oh no, I sent my DNA and the Jews are going to make a virus and kill all white people, they can't. They can't do it to us as easily as we could do it to them. They are so mixed with us. While there are many markers they have that most of us don't have, there are almost no markers we have that at least some of them don't have. They are so thoroughly mixed that if they tried to release a virus to kill us, they kill huge percentages of their own population.
Yeah, I'm not so sanguine about that. I think it would be harder, because we are more diverse in a way than they are. But I think they could, because of their the resources that they have at their disposal, they could find all of the things. And if they catch some non-white goyim in the mix too, oh well, if they wanted to kill us that way, they could.
I think they'd be at risk of killing huge percentages of their own people, but maybe Scott Roberts is right. Maybe the Jewish racial supremacists at the top plan on killing the Mischlings before this is all done and over with anyway.
Well, the point I wanted to make is that they're already basically offing us without genetic technology. They're
right.
Offing us with their media, with their narrative, with their Semitic correctness, and opening our borders and outlawing hate and outlawing Holocaust denial and all the whole shebang is basically choking us to death. It's restricting our ability to organize and defend ourselves. And to keep ourselves from being mixed out of existence, to keep us from excluding people that we want to exclude and that we need to exclude in order to remain ourselves. If we can't exclude people from our living spaces, then we will mix with them eventually just through sheer force of gravity and you know, be overwhelmed and buried, mixed out. And the Jews have kind of an enculturated resistance to this. They have lived as a minority amongst other peoples their whole existence. And they do it through various cultural techniques, the tribalism that they teach their young, and they pass that on, in addition to whatever stronger instinct they might have for racial in-group favoring relative to whites. But they basically have demonstrated that they can put up with it in the sort of the same way that say a big company, this was the sort of theory or the reality of what happened with antitrust in the United States during the go-go days of capitalism. With big companies, they can suffer some losses for a short term and put their competition out of business. And then go back to protective measures that would and raise the rates again. Once all their competitors, their smaller competitors, have been driven out of business, they can go back to making, you know, a killing. And the Jews, in this respect, could do the same thing, are doing the same thing to us with immigration. For the people like Luke Ford who worry that, oh my, why would the Jews destroy themselves too? They aren't going to be destroyed in the short term by such immigration, because they have the techniques to survive it.
Yeah, I mean, I am maybe a tad more optimistic, and I think that some of that is breaking down. Judaism no longer holds them together, and I think that Holocaustianity is loosening its grip as more and more generations pass. As we get further away from the event, I think that may have less sway. And, you know, I don't know how the Jews will fare when they have no ideology holding them together as a group.
Well, they have a simple basic ideology, which is I'm a Jew. I'm righteous and right because I'm a Jew, and you're my enemy. You're an anti-Semite, even if you don't know it yet. And that is a very strong glue, that us versus them. It's basically us versus them. It works. And even the ones that are moving away from the core, the ones that have assimilated or, you know, forgotten that they don't go to synagogue or temple anymore, whatever they, or have mixed with non-Jews, they still retain a very strong sense of themselves as Jews. Maybe ultimately their grandchildren, great-grandchildren won't be Jews anymore, but they'll still be Jews in the core of their gene pool, making new Jews. That's the nature of it. Those Haredim, Chabad type Jews spit out babies like crazy, like Africans, you know?
Yeah, they have a high fertility rate. And I don't know what the rate is, but a lot of them do come out into the general gene pool. They leave the Hasidim lifestyle and come into
that's our
gene pool. Do you remember that story about the Hasidic girl that left Hasidim to become a prostitute?
They leave to become all sorts of things, mostly to, you know, have deleterious effects on our societies. They get into our societies and they tell us, as a fellow white person, I think this or that, or you should do this or that, white people. And it's almost invariably something that hurts white people and helps Jews.
Right. Yeah. And the thing is with Jewishness is it's a psychological profile. It's inherited traits. So, you know, a Jewish person or a person, a Mischling, may not even be aware that they have Jewish ancestry, and they may not identify at all with the Holocaust story or with the religion of Judaism, but they're still going to have Jew-like behavior, Jew-like tendencies. That's one of the problems with the mixing with Jews. On one hand, I see where people are going with the idea of eventually the Jewish problem will solve itself because they'll be gone. But the problem is we've seen that quarter Jews, and even in some cases down to eighth Jews, still have Jew-like behaviors, even if they're not really aware that they're a Jew or even understand what that means to be a Jew. It's still a profile that shows up. I don't know if you've ever read You Gentiles, but in that book, Maurice Samuel, basically, he himself self-admits that at about 1/16 would be around where the person would be totally goyish, that the Jewishness would no longer affect them instinctually or culturally.
Yeah, there's some Jew named Nozick that wrote in a book somewhere a long time ago that Revelo Oliver refers to as one drop, basically, is all it takes to impact that Mischling's view of the world and make them favor Jews and Jew-type agendas. One drop. I think that's right. That's basically how white people should act. I mean, my criticism of mixing with Jews and white people is that whites have not taken Jews seriously enough for our entire history. That's the reason we're in the predicament we're in, is because the Jews have been underestimated and misunderstood for that entire history. And the Jews deliberately cultivate that misunderstanding. They try to create that kind of confusion. They psychopathologize anybody investigating them, scrutinizing them, criticizing them, trying to understand what they're up to. They destroy them if they can't silence them. And so, you know, I understand why it's happened, but if we want to fix this, I mean, there's the long road back to our subject at hand here, CRISPR. The long, hard solution has been tried many times of, you know, there's people who say, well, they'll mix themselves out of existence, or we can maybe flood them with our genes. We'll just mix it up with them and they'll all be gone. I can imagine how maybe the remnants of Alexander the Great's regime in Egypt, in Alexandria, thought that back shortly after the millennia. I think it was 120 AD when Claudius wrote that edict addressing the Jews for what they were doing in Alexandria. I can imagine that those Alexandrians, the descendants of Greeks and as I said, Alexander's conquering army that were still there hundreds of years later, that the Jews were basically in the process of Jewing, that they probably thought similar thoughts and made similar arguments amongst each other about what to do with these damn Jews that are just so hostile to us and eating us alive and opening our gates to foreigners and, you know, whatever, exploiting us and parasitizing us. And they didn't solve their problem, and they were eventually gone, disappeared, exterminated.
Like every other group that's ever
by hook or by crook, like every other group that the Jews have lived amongst, which is another point I make. So, you know, back to CRISPR and people who have qualms about, you know, discussing ways of solving the Jew problem. I don't care what they think, because they're wrong. And the only thing that will stop the Jews, and this is the short, direct solution to the problem, is if a white man with his head in the right place, with the right collection of knowledge and a bit of gumption, were to find a particularly unique, you know, widespread enough that enough Jews carry it, and unique enough to the Jews that only the Jews carry it, bit of DNA to target, and a part of the immune system or endocrine system or something else critical to life that he could knock out, he could do that. It would take just a single dedicated white man that could develop that weapon. The hard part would be how to spread it to Jews. You'd have to figure out how to get it into a mosquito, or how to get it into the cold virus, or some other way to spread it to them. That there would be maybe some more research and development needed there. But the simple part, the targeting and what to knock out, or that would be the relatively simple part. As I've already mentioned, you know, the qualms, the moral, the hand-wringing that a white man would do in his mind, that's also a big obstacle that he'd have to do. I can't do it because I'm compromised now. I love my wife. I love my kids. I wouldn't want to develop a weapon that would kill them. And I'm too old probably anyway to figure out all this technology and figure out how to use it. But I'm honest with myself, and I'll be honest with the people who are listening to this, that I can't do it. But I would not in any way despise or think it was wrong if another white man could figure out how to do it and press that button and made it happen.
No, I mean, long term, I mean, if somebody can do this in their garage, great, go ahead and do it now. And if, you know, it doesn't happen by then, by the time we get a state, if there are still Jews around Jewing, which I'm sure there will be, the first thing that any future white ethnic state will have to do, well, the first thing is completely nuke Israel, and the second thing will be to release something like this.
Yeah, well, even 10 years ago, when I first started looking into race and what are white people and how are we different from Jews, you know, what the hell is a Jew, and realized that Jew was a genetic trait, not a religion. I realized right then that just in the same way you could keep mestizos out of your country by simply doing a genetic screen and say, you know, if you've got X percent of Indio blood, you're not allowed in. You can do the same thing with Jews. They have characteristic patterns in their DNA, and you could simply use that technology, and that freaked them out enough even before CRISPR came along and kind of made the potential for a weapon.
Well, didn't they try to do the same thing to the Palestinians in the 90s, but then they realized that the Sephardic and Maserati were too close and it would kill them too?
Yeah, I remember mentioning that to Henrik Palmgren when this issue of bioweapons came up, that they couldn't develop a bioweapon against Palestinians because they are too closely related to them. But I don't know how true that is. I mean, I think they are genetically similar, but they are probably distinct enough that they could do it. I don't care really about what different tribes of sand niggers do to each other. But you know, for what the Jews have done, the Jewing that the Jews have done to Europeans, they deserve far worse than just ended. And it's not even debatable, really. It's a matter of life and death, really, and that's what it comes down to. I always thought I wanted to make a couple more podcasts that I don't know if I'll ever get around to, but one of them would have been focused on exterminationism and this whole idea of, you know, how evil and rotten it is to genocide or ethnically cleanse or otherwise exterminate your enemies. But that is the historic solution. And that's related to this topic we're discussing here, is, and what freaks out some of the people who are trying to discuss these, what's being uncovered by this genetics research, is that that seems to be the rule in the recent past, is that peoples don't just migrate and mix it up like the Jew narrative paints it. We don't just get vibrant and celebrate our diversity together. One group usually, historically, replaces another in large part.
It's genocide, and to the extent there is admixture, the admixture is a result of rape.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. It's my understanding that what you can do with this kind of technology is you can create just like a basic virus, a flu virus, and you can tie it to another genetic marker where only people will get it. Could you maybe target, say, the conine gene and just basically kill the head vampires and hope that does enough damage?
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting aspects to this that even fall short of a weapon. You could make the weapon really targeted to try and get the Jewish Jews rather than anything that's mixed. You could even use it potentially to repair the ones who are only partly mixed, because, like, say, anyone who's half Jewish, they've got some genes from the other parent that maybe aren't expressing themselves, but could, if you just copied those copies of, say, your mother's genes and made both copies of your genes come from your mother, who's not Jewish, or vice versa, your father, then you could fix yourself. You could basically edit the Jew out of you. So it could be used as a potential treatment of Mischlings. But, you know, that's would be a lot more complicated, a lot less likely to work. But it is a potential solution for people who are only partly Jewish and are would fight tooth and nail against this, that you know, maybe they could actually cure themselves with this technique if it were allowed to be developed.
And yeah, you could create a program. It's my understanding you could program a cure that would go in, find the Jew SNPs, edit them into white people SNPs, and you could actually make this like a virus itself and put it in water or whatever.
Yeah.
All the Jews, without knowing it, would basically get genetically converted into Gentiles, and one morning they'd wake up with a conscience and realize they're horrible people.
It works like search and replace in a text editor, in that you can say, find this strip of DNA, and then nearby, this block of DNA, replace it with this other block of DNA, and or knock it out or whatever, or add a block. You know, there's three different things you can do: replace it, add it, or delete it. Usually, though, when you add or delete something, that's a mutation. You're going to fuck something up. You're going to break something when you do that. Even when you substitute, you could break something. And anyway, you basically got it. Yeah, it's a search and replace, and you can do it in very creative ways. You could just target very specific subgroups of people. And this is where the rubber meets the road. Like I said, the fine differences between the fine racial genetic differences between peoples kind of prove that race is real and it matters, that you can use this tool to target very narrow groups of people with only slight differences in genes from everybody else.
So maybe there is concern for whites. I mean, do you think the Jews, Israelis are working on something to get rid of us right now? Do you think they're trying to find an anti-Semitism gene and we're going to switch?
They're fighting amongst themselves right now, this Jew, alt-Jew phenomenon that we talked about the last time, at least in my estimation. There's, you know, these two main branches. The one that wants to get rid of us now, wanted to get rid of us yesterday, the anti-racist type of Jews that we can't be gone soon enough for their purposes. And then you've got the Zionist Israel first Jews that, whether they live in Israel or not, they, you know, kind of see some use for white people still. They still see us as basically a group that can be exploited for our resources and for our, we're useful to them. I mean, for one thing, I mentioned it the last time, our ability to organize militarily and go stomp on their enemies for them in the Middle East is one of the ways that we're still useful to them, and they don't want to get rid of us. In the same way that we don't want to give up cows and pigs and horses and whatever, you know, the various other forms of life that we use for as resources that we, you could say we parasitize them or whatever, but we exploit for their meat or other, you know, hair or whatever, skin that we use them for. The Jews, basically, that's one of the conundrums that they face with us, is they're a parasite. They need a host to exploit. But a world full of Jews would be like a world full of vampires. They you know,
they would be a very pleasant world.
And I don't think it would go on for very long. I think, it would be a miserable place that no non-Jew would want to even think about. So that's one of the things that gets in the way of them wanting to kill us real fast. I mean, it's one thing for them to kind of slowly suck our blood until we die and open our borders and whatever, you know, preach multiculturalism and race mixing to us, while at the same time then preparing to set up shop in China or Russia, or, you know, actually they've been in Russia a long time. But probably China is the primary new host that they're thinking of switching to next.
I've been thinking about this. The end product in the West, the end miscegenated product, if they get their goal, will actually probably be a 95 to 98 IQ being that could still maintain at least some degree of a second world country, because while they're bringing Somalians into Europe, they're primarily bringing in Middle Easterners and South Asians who are a relatively higher IQ minority. Here in America, they're primarily bringing in mestizos who have about an average of 90. So I think they're, to the extent that there are Jews sitting actually at a table planning, I think their goal is to get like a second world country, the finished product being a 90 to 95 IQ average, something that's almost still arguably Caucasian, but whatever in us they don't like is gone.
Yeah, I think they're trying to breed out the way Revel Oliver put it was the cattle metaphor, that they see us as cattle, and that in the early days of the settling of the West of America, they used this particular breed of cattle, the longhorn cattle, because it was ornery enough to defend itself from predators and to eat the poor pickings of grass that it could find, right? But its meat was kind of tough. And so later on, after the West had been pretty much civilized and fenced in and plowed and planted, then a new breed of cattle could be brought in that was more docile. And the analogy he made was that World War II was sort of a wake-up call to the Jews that these longhorn cattle here could get a little bit uppity and that they needed to go. And it was time to replace them with a more docile breed. And just in basic terms, the multiculturalism does that, whether the people actually mix thoroughly enough or not. In a way, you don't even want them to mix thoroughly, because as long as there's these differences, racial, cultural differences, the people will be so busy fighting with each other that the Jews can do whatever they want. They can direct, it's the let's you and him fight thing, and the divide and conquer thing. They can... And there are experts at this, at sensing who has grievances with who, and manufacturing grievances when no natural grievances exist, and driving wedges between people. And they did it to white people, even when all we had was like religious relatively minor differences amongst ourselves. They came in and divided us up like frickin' cattle, like cowboys would divide a herd of cattle. So it's no doubt going to be easier for them to manage a mixed population, even if it isn't thoroughly genetically mixed to homogeneity.
Right. No, it's kind of the divide and conquer strategy. It's blending in because people are distracted, and they profiteer and make power off of these divisions. It's kind of a silly example, but the Jew promotes feminism, and then the Jew promotes the pickup artist stuff. That they make the problem and then they sell you the solution.
Yeah, all of it. That's right. Yeah, or the other example I can think of that's like that is they destroy your cities, by importing non-whites into it, and then they profit off of gentrifying it.
Yeah. I think isn't it a lot of Jewish realtors that are running those like ready-made, not the suburbs, it's now beyond the suburbs. You know what I'm talking about? Like it's kind of the gated housings that always live off the side of the freeway. They're kind of just these ready-built buildings, and it's becoming a new kind of way people are living. I might be moving into one later this year because it's a bit of a nicer area, but it's just they go out by the side of the highway where there's not a lot of people, and they just build these nice, kind of nicer-looking apartment structures, but they're a little bigger than apartments, and it's actually primarily white people that live in these. That first they ruined the cities, then whites went out to the suburbs, and to some extent they're ruining the suburbs, so now white people are going to live in these little gated apartment complexes off the side of the freeway right next to the Walmarts.
Right, yeah, it's like the instant community thing. It's just another, the latest development in white flight, it sounds like to me, what you're describing. People in their gated communities down the highway from commuting ever farther from where they work, all because we won't confront the Jews that have set up this system that we're suffering under.
Now, the only issue with CRISPR for me isn't a moral one, but it's a political ramification one. Now, if you say if someone just does this in their garage and the deal's done, it's over with. But if a future white ethnostate does it as a state, I worry that like the Chinese will be like, okay, white people just did that. We probably want to get something together to kill them just in case.
It might be the Chinese that do it.
Chinese.
It doesn't. But who the ADL before they give their last gasp and die would blame is, of course, Nazis and racists and whatever. So even if they don't have any evidence of who created the weapon, just the fact that I'm talking about it is would be enough to say, oh, look, the evil racists, they plotted to do this. They conspired to do it. You know, whatever. I think it's going to happen to them eventually. Somebody's going to do it to them because somebody will be unhappy with their parasitism.
Yeah. No.
What makes it inevitable is that anybody can do it. It's not something that requires state level resources and a secure compound in which to do it. Now, one of the downsides or one of the things, ways that they might thwart it is with this increasing spy apparatus that they're setting up with the internet. You know, the internet is a two-edged sword. It allows us to do things like what we're doing, communicate, share ideas, find like-minded people, and to get emotional and psychological support from doing that, all the good stuff that comes from that, build community, basically, remotely. But the other side of it is that it also allows the Jews who control all of the infrastructure, the social media, and even the backbone packet type stuff to monitor it all. And they could very well monitor, even if you were an individual guy listening to this or heard it through some VPN download, you would have to at some point probably go do searches for some of the things that you need to learn or find out. And that's where they would basically, you would appear on their radar and they'd be able to swoop in and stop you from doing it before you could assemble all the pieces.
Interesting. So that's something that people have to think about.
Yeah, please be careful. If you're going to try and do this, don't share it with anybody. Don't, and be careful with, you know, who you talk to about it and what kind of searches you do. Basically, keep it on the down low until
keep
you
it on
do
the
it.
Down low, please. I don't want to see anyone in my comments section tomorrow announcing that they're going to go buy a CRISPR kit online.
Yeah. So I've been thinking about this particular idea for a long time, ever since I learned about CRISPR. It occurred to me, well, shit, you know, the most obvious use of it is against the Jews. And as I said, early discussions of it in the Jewish media were actually wringing hands about the potential uses of bioweapon. They never specifically mention against Jews. They will eventually, it will come out that just like everything else about the current regime, you know, you can see sort of by who's not allowed to be talked about, sort of like the invisible man. You know, you can see him based on what's not there or what, you know, the shadow that he throws or something. It's the same thing with Jew power. Even when it's not explicitly mentioned, you see by who's talking about something or a threat. And the terms that they speak in, Nazi is a good keyword. You know, if they're not worried about Nazis, that you can bet it's the Jews that are the ones worrying about it.
Yeah. No. What was I say? I mentioned something about the CRISPR thing. The other thing is, I guess someone could do this in their garage, but isn't this technically already illegal? I mean, obviously making a weapon to kill people is illegal, but isn't any kind of genetic modification already illegal? Like, isn't that the reason China is kind of lapping us right now, is they can just willy-nilly do human experiments and, like, there's so many regulations here in the
West? I don't think it's technically illegal to do it, certainly not to yourself. And, of course, if you were to develop a weapon to use against anybody, not even just Jews, but you'd probably have the state come down on your head pretty quickly. But, genetically modified food or genetically modified medicine that you sell as medicine, those things probably are illegal. And that's where the Chinese are lapping us. But they could have just as well have been an American scientist who had made this, you know, first announcement, first modified baby announcement. But they probably would have lost whatever job they had with whatever university or lab because of Semitic correctness. And moral reasons, not legality.
Right. I was under the impression that there already were like human experimentation laws in many Western countries.
Yeah, well, this could be, you know, it could fly under that radar because
yeah,
it's not
the radar. No, I'm not.
You could claim it's just me modifying myself and my own germline. So, I'm not I'm not impacting anybody else. You know, make the libertarian argument, I guess. I don't know. As long as you're not, like I said, not selling it to anybody else, then you could do that. But, you know, speaking of selling things, you can buy CRISPR kits now. And what you can't find online, just an open source form, as far as, you know, this is how you do this, this is what you need to do that. There's a lot of that. But then apparently, and I haven't looked into it too deeply, like I said, it would be a dead end for me anyway. I cannot do this. But to the extent I've looked into it, apparently you can order kits that are relatively cheap to do at least some playing around with the genome to proof of concept. Say, and somebody who knows more about genetics and biology than I do would probably find it pretty easy to do some of this stuff.
Didn't some guy with a home kit like change his eye color?
I hadn't heard that one.
I know that somebody with a home kit made.
But you could. Yeah. You could, at least to make your eyes. Forget which one it is. I think blue is the lack of melanin in the eye. And brown is a certain melanin in the eye. So you'd have to like create the missing DNA to turn blue eyes into brown. It would be senseless to speculate about it. But yeah, it can be done because it is a genetic difference. That's what makes somebody have brown eyes or blue eyes or green eyes, is basically the mix of genes that they have. It's just another question of it would be, how complicated is it? How many different places in the genome would you have to change the eye color?
Yeah. Now, I want people to be careful if they do this, but if any of this stuff is available on the surface web now, I can promise you, if you knew where to look on the dark web, there's probably already some pretty weird kits and shit on the dark web for CRISPR.
Yeah. And one of the things you'd need to know, which is not even necessarily CRISPR related, is what do I need to knock out that would cause somebody to die, cause their body to fail in some way and that couldn't be fixed too quickly. That would be simple to knock out. You know, what critical strip of DNA? And I'm sure that there's thousands of places that are potential targets for that kind of thing.
Yep. No, it sounds good. I hope this happens. You know, I mean, if tomorrow I could press a button and do it, I would. I'm not like Billy Roper. I don't go full on like getting rid of everyone. But at this point, I understand that if this problem isn't solved, it'll eventually come back and bite us in the ass, eventually. I mean,
there's a lot of the discussion about CRISPR has to do with that for the most part, they're discussing, at least in the open, how to use this to solve problems, cure diseases, or coincidentally, how to exterminate mosquitoes, for instance, because, you know, mosquitoes carry malaria and kill millions of hominins in Africa every year, whatever, hundreds of thousands. So they're actually thinking about just doing away with mosquitoes using CRISPR. They want to genetically modify or spread amongst the mosquitoes genetic modifications that will make them sterile. And so
exterminate an animal species that does we don't even know yet what for the ecosystem to save a bunch of useless niggers.
Well, the at least when it comes to mosquitoes, the discussion is, well, what there might be unintended consequences there. What if birds that eat these mosquitoes don't have a food supply anymore, then those birds are going to die, and so on. You know, that's the fear they have. The other fear they have is, what if the genetic modifications that we spread, even though we target mosquitoes with it, maybe what if it spreads to other species? What if it mutates in some way that we don't foresee and kills far more than we intend to kill? And I suppose that's where it comes back to, what if I design a weapon to kill Jews biologically, genetically, that somehow mutates and ends up killing everybody or ends up killing my people.
Why is it killing Italians or Greeks?
Yeah.
But no,
So again, just to remind people who might be listening to this, Greeks and Italians aren't going to exist soon anyway, along with all the other white people.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of, you know, survival. It's a matter of who's going to kill who first, really.
Yeah, because I maintain that when we get an ethno state, and I do believe that'll happen, Israel will probably almost immediately go for the Samson option.
Yeah, I laugh, but that's basically the lesson of National Socialist Germany, is that the Jews can't tolerate even a subset of the Goyim having independence from their Jewing and excluding them. They're worried, and it's a valid concern of theirs, that that group of Goyim would then be a shining beacon to other Goyim of what kind of prosperity you could have if only you throw off your own parasite. And I think they don't say it that way, but that's what they're thinking about why National Socialist Germany is so evil. You know, why Hitler wanted to conquer the whole world and exterminate all the Jews. That's the conclusion they know it would come to. Whether Hitler actually had plans to do that or not, that doesn't explain really why he built so much concrete fortifications along the coast of Europe to defend Europe from invasion, if his goal was to conquer the world. And maybe, and you know, in hindsight, that should have been maybe a higher priority to make nice with the other Goyim that were eventually used to destroy National Socialist Germany, even if it was humiliating or more difficult than the road they went down. In hindsight, that might have worked. I'm talking about basically, you know, preventing the war, you know, funding or otherwise encouraging America First type movements, you know, shamelessly, instead of saying, oh, well, you know, National Socialism isn't for export and we have no intention of, you know, and really they didn't, as far as I know, manipulate other foreign countries, certainly not like the Jews do. Instead, go the opposite route of trying to take the Jews head on, even in other countries outside of Germany. But you know, that's all water under the bridge.
The Boone, he should have supported the Boone. And when Japan went AWOL and did Pearl Harbor, he should have broke the treaty with Japan and sided with Americans.
Yeah, I don't want to even get into second-guessing what the National Socialists did or didn't do.
No, it's not worthwhile.
It's not productive, but it is, I think, the main takeaway is basically, again, do not underestimate, do not misunderstand the situation with the Jews. And just basically take it more seriously the next time around. It could be the last chance.
Yeah. No, I mean, we eventually have to do something. If for no other reason, to just give ourselves the breathing room and the time to eventually just leave the planet.
Yeah, I don't think we will. We don't have that luxury. Not with this. Not with the way things are.
No, but I mean, if we get rid of the Jews, I think we can keep the non-whites at bay long enough to just leave the planet.
Oh, that wouldn't even be a problem, I don't think. We wouldn't have to be thinking about trying to abandon the place where we developed and are adapted for. We wouldn't need to. If we didn't have this parasite that had basically pithed our brains, then we would be able to organize and do what's required to do what's best for us, to not only survive but thrive, to build a wall. We wouldn't need to build a wall because we'd have government officials that actually represented our interests and did what was good for us.
Yeah.
And if they didn't, they would be replaced by people who would, you know, instead of this totally Jude system that we live under right now. And that Europeans have lived under for, you know, the last 2,000 years in various times and places and severities.
Yeah, I've talked about this a few times. I talked about my Paradise Stolen, about what could have been had we not had these Jews. I talked about in my video, do you really understand how bad the problem is? The arguing about oil and the environment, you know, between pro-white people is kind of silly, because it's like, once we get rid of these Jews, we have no idea what kind of technology is going to come out of the woodwork that either they hid away or that our people are able to develop freely once we don't have these people eroding and corrupting everything.
Yeah, and their National Socialism, again, could provide some hint as to what kind of benefit there is to removing the parasitic load, that within just a few short years, National Socialist Germany had turned Germany from a an economic and racial basket case into a shining example of thriving society. And that's a very obvious and stark change. And it all had to do with removing the Jews from power over them in Germany. Now imagine if the United States, something similar could be done, or Britain or France or whatever. But the lesson of National Socialist Germany was that if you do it yourself and you just say, well, we can't control these other countries, we've just got to do it for ourselves, and we got to just think inside our own borders and whatever, set up our ethnostate. Well, the Jews will bring down hell on your head by organizing all the other peoples of the planet to invade your country and destroy you.
Yeah, no, we are definitely going to have to figure something out with CRISPR, or some kind of weapons to hold everything at bay, because, any ethno-state created, they would try to destroy almost immediately. Now, I know we're up on 3 hours, so I know you probably are getting tired, and I told the chat we would take their final questions before we ended it, so I just wanted to let you know that.
Yeah, I'll take a couple of questions, but yeah, you're right, it's a little long here, so let's wrap it up. Do we have any questions?
Yeah, scroll up. There's a couple. Okay, we don't want to scroll up forever. So the people that were asking earlier about when we're going to take questions, maybe retype them.
Yeah, somebody was asking about the people who are asking the questions too, that they're still here asking. Okay. We need to rally veterans.
I'm skeptical of the veterans thing. I think a lot of them are very mentally poisoned on the Zyokon shit.
Well, you know, there is a rubber band thing there where, yes, their heads are screwed to the point and they're compromised themselves to the point that they participated in being a Zogbot. And when they learn that awful truth, it is just as likely to make them ever more staunch supporters of the regime than opponents of it. But there is also the rubber band. I mean, is basically it snaps in your head this that you've been betrayed, that you've been lied to. And when you find out that you've been defrauded, another natural reaction to that is anger.
True.
The other thing here is CRISPR for sterility, not death. It's not going to work. If you just sterilize the Jews will have time to figure out how to unsterilize themselves and kill you. So, you know, it's going to be, it's got to be abrupt, and it's got to be final, and it's got to be death. It can't be sterility. It can't be nice. What's GM for the people says he posted like 10 questions.
The only one I saw was something about, were you aware of the home kits, the home CRISPR kits?
That's one thing I mentioned, that you can get these things that will let you play with CRISPR. I don't know how deeply it plays. You know, it's like Tinker Toys or what. But you can start to play around with CRISPR with kits that you can order at home. But if you do that kind of thing, it would be better to try and get it anonymously, get it mailed to a PO box or something, so that it's not, or even you'd have to go beyond PO box, because that's it can be attached, traced to you. I don't know how to go about it. Here, let me scroll back some of these other things here. Birdie's got a whole series here of comments. What should younger people do? Intellectualize or prepare for the worst? People, when they are asked questions about how should the problem be solved, they usually will say, well, you know, I think more people need to do what I'm doing. And I'm conscious of that. And I don't really try to even advise people what to do. I made some stupid comment when Luke Ford asked me, what should young people do? Somebody asked the question. And I said some stupid boomer thing like keep your powder dry. And I felt horrible about that days afterward. So I'm not going to give anybody any advice on anything what to do. But, you know, basically I'm showing you what I'm doing. I'm trying to understand things, and I'm trying to then share that understanding with other people. And when that reaches a critical mass of people that understand, eventually you'll get the Dylan Roof of biology that will do the deed.
Yeah, and, you know, right now is not necessarily the time for people to be going off the chain quite yet, because they can still make hell. But soon the system is going to banana republic enough that, and we're going to get the truth out enough that you're going to have random people that aren't even, quote unquote, our guys taking action. And that's going to, like in Europe with the Muslims just randomly beating up Jews, we're going to start to see that here in America. And even from white people in Europe, I'm not advocating anything. FBI, please don't bully. But the day is coming where random people that aren't even connected to our circles are going to find things out, and they're going to have the normal reaction of, oh, shit. And then they're just going to go do something. They're not going to talk about it. They're just going to go do something. They're going to nut up one day and do something.
Yeah, well, that's back to the instinct I mentioned at the very beginning of the podcast, that people instinctively know who is us and who is them at a certain base level, and they don't really need science or intellectuals to tell them one way or the other. But that is also where the Jews do best. How they manipulate people who have instincts, they redirect them. You mentioned this in your pathological altruism thing, identity can be hijacked, and the Jews are experts at hijacking and rerouting the energy that would be, if it were left to itself or organized collectively by its own group, could be set to great purposes and great effect. The Jews are able to shatter it and, you know, direct most of it down a frickin' hole and direct another bunch of it into wars to benefit them and their in whatever way they want. And, you know, it's because they're conscious and they're active and they're communicating with each other and they're organizing, all things that we can't compare. We don't have. And if we start to try to build it, they come along and they kick it over.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you've heard me promote the theory, but I believe our people are going through a bottleneck, and the future generations of white people are actually going to be more ethnocentric than previous ones, because it's really only right-leaning, ethnocentric white people that are breeding.
Yeah, Bertie here says, I agree with you. It's already happening, basically. The whites who are mixing themselves out. Bertie says, I'm not saying give orders. It's more about how one should use their time. Be a pragmatist. You know, try and learn some valuable real world skills, you know, something. I'm a technical guy myself, software, but I know how to do plumbing. I know how to do electrical. I know how to do, you know, hammer and saw and all of that. Those are good things to have. I don't, you know, if you're a young guy, make sure you know how to do that stuff. Make sure you know how to handle a chainsaw.
Yeah, I wish I had developed more skills. I guess, I mean, I'm still young enough. I probably should at some point.
It's also, it's good for you too. There is something to that, what Ted Kaczynski called the power process, you know, putting food on your own table by going out and hunting, or putting wood in your own wood stove to heat your house rather than, you know, cashing your paycheck and paying the electric company. So,
okay.
I don't know. That's how I keep my sanity.
Yeah. Here's one question in the chat that's pretty concise, but it might open a can of worms. Martial law too. Question: how Jewish do you have to be considered a Jew, in your opinion?
Well, we talked about that earlier. I think one drop is perfectly reasonable for white people to draw the line and say, you know, we might tolerate one drop of Negro or whatever, Congoid, or one drop of any other race, but Jew, it's just poison, and no, we can't afford it. So, I that's where I would draw the line. Although, you know, like I've already pointed out, my wife is half Jewish. My kids are one quarter Jewish. I'm screwed, and my family is screwed. But that doesn't mean I'm going to start advising white people that they need to let in quarter and half Jews that are good. You know, that would be stupid. for white people.
Yeah, I mean, I the Jew thing is like a separate thing. I don't know where I stand on the level of admixture. I mean, I know.
Thanks, Bertie. I'll check my email. Yeah.
I know for a fact I wouldn't want, you know, all the way down to a quarter Jew, I wouldn't want a quarter Jew. And I really would be skeptical of an eighth Jew. Although I always like to make the distinction. Genealogy and genetics are separate. You get 50% from each parent, but it's random. So technically being genealogically a quarter, I've heard the range can vary as much as 0 to 34%.
Yeah. Well, look, if things were different, if organized Jewry was gone, if the core of Jewing was removed and no longer causing problems, and the only thing left were quarter Jews, eighth Jews, then you could see that, yeah, okay, maybe they're okay. Maybe we can absorb them and not deal with them like they should be dealt with. And that's what the National Socialists did. They say, once we got the Jews out of power of our banks and our government and our media, then we allowed even quarter Jews to serve in our military and have roles of responsibility. And I don't think that was make or break for their war effort, but there's no real reason to have that kind of compassion. There's no compelling reason for white people to have that kind of liberal attitude about it. It should be more of a final all or nothing type of thing, because the Jews certainly see it that way and will ultimately make it that way.
Yeah, no, I definitely, like I said, I would definitely lean on the side of caution. Generally, I lean on the side of caution, you know, about 1/16th, 1/32nd. For different things, I mean, it varies. I actually recently got in trouble because I made a point of, okay, you know, one day we're going to have an ethnostate. Maybe we can let in people that are 1/8 non-white, but we don't need those people leading the movement now. And I criticized Nick Fuentes and James Alsup, and I got some shit for that because it's like, oh, they do such great work. And it's like, well, they openly reject the label of white nationalist. I mean, I don't want to drag you into that hole. But anyway, I got some shit for pointing out white identity movement should be led by phenotypic whites that don't have any personal hangups to that degree. And people are like, oh, blah, 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 blah. Purity's
yeah, fine. They should be white people. White people should be leading white people. And Jews are not white. And even partly white, partly Jew people really should be treated as suspect and as ineligible for that reason. And people who call themselves racialists, who think that race is important, should not have any qualms about that and should stop making excuses for the Jews. The Jews are the people who are driving whites to extinction. It's the Jews.
Yep.
You know, when these people like Steve King, this really upsets me, when Steve King, who obviously sees that Western civilization is under threat, who does he think is doing it? Who does he think is behind it? And this is the point that I've been hammering on for 10 or so years now, is there's a whole bunch of people who do not want to, because they know the answer or because they don't really want to know the answer, who talk about the symptoms of Jewing, and they try to either blame white people for it, or they try to ignore that it's Jews. I mean, which are basically two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, it's a desire to not deal with the issue or to try to pad the issue. I recently had a falling out with somebody OV because he kept promoting and he kept kind of trying to steer conversations towards the idea of we can out-Jew the Jew and we can kind of play the right-wing Zionist Jews off against the left-wing Jews. And I wasn't having it, you know. And at a certain point, it's like, that's off the table. We cannot outsmart these people. We cannot outmaneuver these people. We have to just have a wall up, us and them. Anything they say, we have to assume is false. It's just Jew man bad. It has to be just that level of tribalism.
Yeah, we can outdo them. CRISPR is an example of that, where a single motivated white man with the right knowledge can outdo their whole goddamn tribe. But We can't out-Jew them. We can't use Jew tactics and try to out-Jew them. We can't divide and conquer them, because that's something that they're doing to us. They're hyper-conscious of it. They're hyper-conscious of the value of doing it and of who's doing it to who. And they're not going to, for one second, fall for white people trying to do it to them.
No, because like you've said before, they're hyper-conscious. And the reality is, it's two groups of people that hate. They're not even two different groups. It's two different big sides of the same coin that hate you and just have different ideas about what needs to be done to you. The idea that you're going to manipulate the Zionist Jews into letting us have a white ethnostate, or at least white majority countries, is absurd.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's really only white people who think in these terms of, well, you know what, can't we all be racists and get along? We'll have our ethnostate, and everybody should have their own ethnostate, and we don't have a problem with Jews having their own ethnostate. Jews don't think like that. It's like, we've got our state, and we're going to make damn sure nobody else threatens us by having their own. We're going to have our fingers in every other state in the world as well, and we're going to make sure that they do what we need to be done for our benefit. That's their mentality.
Yeah.
And it's a winning mentality. I mean, up until the point where it pisses off enough or the right people to, or the wrong people, that gets them all CRISPRed.
Yep.
And one last joke is, how ironic that the solution to the Jew problem turns out to be something called CRISPR.
Yeah, that is kind of funny.
Let me answer a couple more comments and questions here. I want to thank, is it Marshall Law? Yeah, Marshall Lore said good interview. Thanks, Marshall. Confronting Zionism and attacking it as a terroristic ideology. Wouldn't that be an effective tactic? It would certainly be more effective than saying, I'm okay with the Jews having Israel. Why can't we have something like that, which is weak?
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah, the Catholic high school situation. I saw that all over Twitter today. But that's why I like conversations like this, and I don't mind that it's not particularly popular. What we're talking about here is pretty esoteric information that about the roots and the DNA and all of that, and even these details about Jewing, that most people really aren't interested in. They're more interested in these mainstream things that happen, the everyday news churn, news cycle churn.
The news, just they chatter about the latest event for a couple of days, and then they chatter about the new latest event for a couple of days. Someone asked the question, I know it's too late to get into, maybe we can talk about it another time, but somebody asked, if you had an ethnostate, what would be the legal definition of white? And that's actually an issue that I've been thinking of and debating and kind of mulling over, is a purely biological definition versus a definition with ethnic aspects, because there are groups that are fairly close to us genetically that are very culturally different and don't exist in Europe. Chechnyans are actually the group that kind of began me thinking on this issue. I don't know if you're familiar with the guy's channel, Mesa Man. He's not white, he's like Iranian or whatever, but he's into genetics. And he created a racial census thing, and he did his own categories, and he used phenotype, appearance, haplogroups, maternal and Y chromosomal, autosomal clustering, and he also factored in culture, linguistic factors, and he basically placed all literal Caucasian people, people in Central Asia, Caucasus, as being more part of the Middle Eastern group than the white group. He didn't feel that the Chechnyans were European, and there's other weird little groups that are, for all intents and purposes, genetically West Eurasian, with very little Negroid-Mongoloid admixture, but are not ethnically European. And the debate about what we do with them. Personally, I like the idea of just ethnic Europeans, but I don't know. It's like, on one hand, if we claim to be all about the genetics, should we just let in everyone who's genetically white, or should we also add the cultural element of European?
Yeah, well, I didn't mention it, but I wanted to, about lumpers and splitters, this sort of philosophical divide. It comes into play here. It all depends what your predilection is and what kind of critical mass of people that you could get around you to get together a nation that defines its borders in whatever way you want. You know, you could be very strict about it and be a splitter, you know, somebody who sees fine distinctions and thinks that they're important enough to make draw lines around. Or you could be a lumper. And this is terminology, by the way, that comes from the species problem in biology of and especially in anthropology, paleoanthropology, the classification of these various different types of hominin. Are they Homo sapien or not, or whatever? So the lumpers are the types who want, like Jews, want to basically think of us as all one big migrating, mixing nigger race. And the splitters are the people who see finer distinctions. And racialists generally tend to be people who are splitters, people who are draw finer lines. I don't know what to advise. You know, I guess I would love to see a white planet, you know, nothing but other people who look like me and think like me, whose mind I understand, as that English poet once put it, whose mind I know, whose lies I know, you know, rather than these scheming, sinister looking people who just are looking to screw me over. That would be great. But how we get from where we are now, where whites are a minority, to there, I don't know. CRISPR, I guess. But that's a little maybe too easy a solution.
Well, if it works, it works.
Yeah, if it works, it works. Some people say, I remember this in early debates about the Jews, you know, even if you got rid of all the Jews, we would still have our problems and there'd be other races that would take advantage of us. Well, how about we try that and see what happens, you know, and remove that problem and see if another problem crops up and then deal with that one.
Yeah, it's the dumbest argument. It's like, you know, we can
Kipling, yes.
They're a
Kipling.
Problem. And then they're like, okay, well, Jews are a problem today, but you can't get rid of them because then you'll just have another problem tomorrow. That is the dumbest fucking thing I've ever heard anyone argue. I've heard people do it, and I just, it floors me every time. It's like, wow.
Yeah. I've heard them all, I think.
Yep.
All right, Norvin. Pretty good discussion, I think. We covered a lot of ground and went for a long time. I want to download this right away, though, and I may have to ask you for a copy back channel if I can't get it from YouTube.
Yeah, I think my stuff's open where anyone can download it, and I'm going to download it right away, too, as soon as it's done processing.
All right. Well, good talking to you, and I'll talk to you again soon. I'm sure we can come up with another thing. A topic to discuss another 6 months or a year.
Okay, good. Good talking to you. Thanks for coming on, Tim. And again, thank you for all your work and the influence you've been on me.
You're welcome, Norvin. I'm happy to do it. That's, you know, part of the charge I get out of it is just I'm curious about these things anyway. Organizing and kind of distilling it down and putting it out there for other people to get a sort of pre-digested source of it is makes me happy, and hear from people that it does help them, helps me. It makes me feel good.
Good. I'm glad.
All right. Have a good night, Norvin, and good night, everybody on the chat.
Night, everyone.